It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. O'Malik is here along with Ian Thompson and Aaron Griffith. We're going to talk about the week's news. We'll talk about internet.org. Om has some strong opinions there. And what's going on at Twitter? Big layoffs ahead. It's all next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 546, recorded Sunday, January 24th, 2016. Do I look like an angel to you? This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com. And by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used gadgets. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give new life to a used device. Visit Gazelle.com today. And by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com right now. Click the microphone and enter Twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Hello, everybody. Yes, it's that time once again. And joining us at the Twit table, some lovely people, starting with Ian Thompson from the Register, register.co.uk. Welcome. Good to see more
always,
of you.
Always good to see you again, Leah.
I feel like we see a lot of you. This is good. I'm not complaining.
Well, you know, it's I get around a bit. You know,
we like it, and we like the received in English accent too. I think that's awesome. It gives us, it makes us a little posher.
I should say nothing. Right?
See, doesn't just even saying that is posh. That's Erin Griffith, also from Fortune magazine. She has a wonderful new URL. Fortune.com/unicorn tears will lead you to all her articles on Fortune. That is really jolly. Are you taking up a teaching in your part? Because it looks like you have a chalkboard in your...
That is a chalkboard that was gifted to me by an old roommate years ago.
I love that. Do you use it for brainstorming and stuff?
I use it for my to-do list, which currently has getting a New York ID. I'm coming up on my 10-year anniversary of living in New York, and I have yet to get an ID in the New York State. So that's the one thing on the top of my to-do list on the chalkboard.
So you have a driver's license from Maryland? Where do you?
Ohio.
Ohio. Yeah. That cactus must feel really lost and alone in snow, snow-ridden New York City, I must say.
Yeah, it's kind of lonely.
Are you snowbound? Are you stuck in home?
I left the house today, and there's snow-covered cars where there's literally just a tiny little rearview mirror sticking out from the snow. That's all you can see of the car.
27 inches. But those got buried by snowplows probably, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like people are digging out their cars and throwing the snow into
other
the street,
cars.
And then into the street, and then the street plow comes and just pushes it back onto the cars. It's like this passive aggressive little fight they're having.
That's all right; it'll all be slush in a few hours anyway.
Yeah, tomorrow's gonna be pretty gross.
Yeah, it's so nice though when it falls. I've seen so many great videos. 27 inches total, I think, was the last I saw. And it's been very – Casey Neistat did a wonderful video of him snowboarding down Broadway through Times Square.
Yeah, I saw some pictures of that.
Wow.
Yeah, my in-laws are totally snowed in at the moment, but they're okay. They've got food, they've got fuel, they've got alcohol, and they've got books. You know,
that's
all you need to make it through.
Also with us, O'Malik, from formerly of Giga Om, now from Om.co. Hey, Om.
Hello, Leo.
World traveler.
No.
You just got back from somewhere.
No.
No?
I've been home for almost 2 months.
Wow.
I know. It does sound crazy.
Are you going somewhere soon?
No. I was going to go to New York, and I'm glad I didn't go.
Jeff Jarvis went to Davos this week, and he's stuck in Zurich. Aww. Can't fly home. Aww.
Very expensive place to get stuck,
is it?
Though. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't like getting shafted on bills, Switzerland is not the place
to visit. It's a pricey country.
Oh, yeah. Very. Yes.
Well, speaking of price, we know a little bit about how much Google has made on Android and other things from the Oracle-Google lawsuit. Google's not happy about this. It's, among other things disclosed, this is the lawsuit over Java. Google paid Apple $1 billion in 2014, in 1 year, to keep Google as the default search provider for iOS.
Yeah.
Not much to Apple, but still, not, you know, $1 billion is $1 billion.
Yeah, but, I mean, good deal for Google as well, because they're going to make more than that out of it. I've got to say, Apple, when it comes to doing their contract negotiations, must be a bit sort of... yeah, okay, another billion here, a billion there. Sooner or later, it adds up to real money, so, you know.
I wonder if Apple, though, I mean, you're right. I mean, they don't need the money, but I wonder if they like, if just for pride, they are just tough negotiators. We're Apple. You give us money, Google.
What's their alternative, Bing?
Yeah, that's what they say, right? That's what Google says. What's your,
yeah.
Go ahead, use DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, as soon as people search on that, they're going to be confused and just switch the default to Google anyways. So they may as well just say, okay, fine, $1 billion. That's not that much. You're going to make $10 billion on this over the course of a year. It'll be interesting though, because Google's businesses, I think, already has or will soon shift to be more mobile than not mobile.
Right.
And at that point, Apple might be able to charge a lot more because they'll realize how crucial that is to Google's overall business.
I'm looking at an article from 2014 about talking about iOS 8 and OS 10. Of course, this is, 2 years ago almost. Apple will let you ditch Google search for DuckDuckGo. But this never happened. I suspect this was Apple saying to Google, see?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
We could do it.
I know. Just
interesting,
like,
that the headline says let.
Yeah.
As in?
Allow.
That's like a present they're giving us?
Yeah. You may. Yeah. You will be allowed.
Oh, you know, I mean, it was just basically so they could go into, you know, chat to Apple and go, nice search engine you've got there. Be a shame if anything happened to it, wouldn't it? You know?
Be a shame if a duck were to fly through your window at some point there. We learned that in the lifetime of Android, Google has generated $31 billion in revenue. So Android's been a profitable enterprise. $22 billion of that profit. I'm not sure what the other $9 billion went to, but maybe, I guess, writing and supporting Android. Where did the money come from? Well, it says it makes money for Google in two ways. Advertisements on Android phones, mm-hmm. and then, of course, the Google Play Store, the revenue. So that's not an insignificant amount.
No, I mean, Microsoft makes a significant amount of money out of Android as well, because it's managed to gather enough of a patent pile that it can actually sort of say, you know, big thick pile of patents here. If it went to court, right, that could be very expensive. So why don't you just pay us some licensing fees?
The rumor was for a while, and I don't think anybody knows the exact amount, although maybe they've been revealed as this has in court documents, but the last I heard was $5 per Android handset, yeah, which that would add up. They're making a lot more on Android than they're making on Windows Phone. That's
they're making
sure
a lot more than phone manufacturers are making out of Android as well. It's but yeah, Windows Phone, it's sweet. But you know, it's...
Lest you believe that a $22 billion profit is meaningful, 9 to 5 Mac immediately jumped into the fray. Benjamin Mayo writing, well, Apple made more from an iPhone in a single quarter than Google's made in all of Android history.
I hate that headline. That's so stupid.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about devices.
Hardware and, yeah, it's a completely different.
Well, you have to add in how much Samsung, how much every phone maker, you know, makes selling Android phones if you really want to compare it apples to apples. Oh, that's a terrible pun.
It was inevitable, though, wasn't it? We knew that would happen at some point.
Yeah, but I think that comparison is so silly.
This is one of the side effects. One of the negative side effects of these lawsuits that fly around Silicon Valley is what gets revealed in discovery.
Why are you saying it's a side effect? And why is it bad? It's
well, I think, good, you know? I think about the Apple-Samsung lawsuit. Apple sued Samsung, and yet so much was revealed about Apple's process that I think Apple might have come to regret that lawsuit, even though they got some huge amount of money in the settlement.
I'm not so sure there was that much revealed. And even if it did, nobody can replicate what they do as a collective, right? I think there is a lot which is made out of the whole, oh, you know, Apple details are out, secrets are out. It still is Apple doing what Apple does and Google doing what Google does. And this is just, you know, part of the process, the cost of doing business. I like that all these lawsuits are happening because it keeps reporters busy and, you know, they got something interesting to report on. I mean,
Otherwise,
they will write those clickbait articles like, you know, one quarter revenue versus all of Android. So there you go. I think it just is better if we have details.
I completely agree. But, maybe this is from the outside, maybe a misunderstanding, but one feels like there's almost Apple has some sort of visceral aversion to anybody knowing anything about what goes on inside One Infinite Loop. And it's just like, oh my God, they found out that we have a design team. Oh my God.
That's not just Apple though. That's the case I don't cover Apple as closely as I cover Google and Facebook, but they are equally as controlling about what kinds of information they do more outreach because they want, you know, positive stories and they want stories to be told about what they're doing and they want their innovation to be praised. But they, if there's some, I mean, they're still very controlling and very protective of the kind of information that gets out. And the best stuff is always from leaks or, you know, from lawsuits like this.
Who is the most open Silicon Valley company?
You.
Who do you guys find easiest to cover?
The smallest ones, because they're desperate to be covered, so they'll share stuff.
Yeah.
Like the bigger you are, the more at stake there is, and the less benefit you have from talking to a reporter and having some executive say something stupid or that's taken out of context, or something that could end up helping one of your competitors. They the bigger and more powerful you are, the less, you know, motivation you have to be transparent.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, we saw this with Apple. Their entire PR strategy for the last 10 years has been don't tell anyone anything unless that we know that they're a friend of ours. A lot of other companies have hooked up onto that as well. So, yeah, you're right. The smaller the company, the more open they are about talking about their tech.
If I were a PR person, though, I'd almost say there's nothing to be gained by talking to the press, period.
Then you've got to ask yourself, what is your job? Because there are 4.2 PR people for every one journalist in this country.
Well, that's why they don't say that.
But I mean, I can understand there's the crafting the message side of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, informing the press to inform the populace would strike me as kind of the PR's
Why
job.
Should the populace know anything at all? Why, just the populace should get everything it needs from advertising.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Right?
Because, you know, when somebody actually has to pay money to try and convince you to buy a product, that means it must be really worth buying.
Can I actually make one point here? As somebody who's no longer part of the business, I will say that the way tech media has become today, you know, you step away and you realize that actually you don't need it very much.
Yeah.
Like, I think the noise which passes as news is becoming so high that it is actually pretty strange that, you know, we actually focus on anything meaningful anymore. I think that is the bigger challenge. I think the most of the media people, the PR people, have done a great job of focusing attention away from real news to noise. And I think, you know, it's like people are writing about, you know, internet.org as if it's the second coming of Jesus. And what essentially it is like a ploy to kind of, you know, have an insidious control over the what seems to be the internet for the rest of the planet. And most of the press is not covering that angle. They're covering what is the easier PR accessible angle on that story. And I think that's what I mean is that it's all of it is just noise now. I think very few people are actually digging into deeper stories anymore.
I'm glad you brought this internet.org up. I don't know. Did we talk about this last time you were on?
I think I may be the only person who keeps talking about this. It seems like I'm... Well, you know, whistling in the wind.
I am going to play the opposite just because I want to hear, because I understand what you're saying. Internet.org, which is Facebook's initiative to bring internet access to developing nations where they don't presumably, I would assume, where they don't have any internet access at all. But it's very, it's a weird kind of, it's not really internet access. It's access to Facebook, but not just Facebook. It's also Wikipedia. It's other, it's additional stuff. Is it
Facebook, Facebook approved stuff?
But there Wikipedia is, no is, I mean, it's not just like certain parts of Wikipedia that Facebook likes. It's the whole Wikipedia, right?
No Google, no Twitter, you know, things which fit into the, it's like their idea of what is the internet. And my issue with this whole, you know, thing is that, okay, if you want to do, you know, connect people and give them access to Facebook approved access, don't call it internet.org, call it facebook.org. This is, you know, it's disingenuous to call it internet.org because Facebook is not internet. And to call it internet.org is actually, you know, the first sin of the whole thing.
But
didn't they change the name of it, though, they haven't. Recently? They changed it to Free Basics?
Free Basics, but it's internet.org Free Basics. It's like, okay, no. Just change the name of the organization completely. And I think we have to look at this from a very, from a cultural standpoint, right? Like, look at, in the pre-industrial or early industrialization, when Industrial Revolution happened, the East India Company was the spearhead of the British Empire in a way that they controlled the two most important commodities you needed, like, for economic growth. One was labor and the other was actual commodities. In the post-internet age, attention and connectivity are the two limiting factors to economic growth. So by controlling those, you know, points, what you're looking at is Facebook is trying to control what will happen in the future. I think people look at it and just say, no, this is just the internet. But if Facebook algorithm can decide who wins the elections, let's say in Egypt or in India or wherever, that is not a good situation to have. They never address those issues directly. They don't address the insidious nature of internet.org and its impact on local governments and local, you know, populations. So I understand that they are trying to do good by give access to people. But I don't think it's as simple as that. This is all about, you know, about advertising, making money, and decisions which will be made based on how Facebook makes more money in the future. Right now, you know, you can say whatever you want, but in, you know, this, I draw the parallel between what was the East India Company, and I think Facebook is trying to do somewhat the same thing, in my opinion.
It's, you know, you raise a good point. You have standing to raise this. You're Indian. You know India better, far better than I do. Isn't it the choice though between this and nothing at all? And I look at some of the Free Basics platform does allow people to supply and become part of it. And I look at now, admittedly, these are provided by Facebook, the success stories. Maya, a women's health support network. It sees 71% of its traffic from Free Basics. They're providing women's health information. Baby centers reach 3.4 million people with information for pregnancy and parenting through Free Basics alone. These are people who wouldn't get this information otherwise. I agree with you. I understand the issue of we don't want one incumbent to control elections and so forth. But they have. I don't have a problem with them being a for-profit. You can't say, well, you shouldn't be, you've got to, this has to be a nonprofit. No NGO is stepping up and doing this. Facebook is stepping up and doing it. Isn't it better to have this than nothing at all?
Well, here's the thing is, you look at most of these countries, they have a very competitive telecom environment. Not only that, they actually do have, you know, internet available to a lot of people much more at prices which are much lower than what we pay for in the U.S.
So right? These people are served anyway?
People have access to these technologies. So by saying that Facebook is subsidizing access to these things doesn't mean that they are doing the right thing. If they want to subsidize access to Facebook, just Facebook or Facebook-approved sites, they should do that. But that doesn't mean they should call it internet.org. That doesn't mean they should be using that as a single play to access all the information. I think by becoming gatekeepers of information, there is a much deeper problem they can cause in the long term. I mean, I am absolutely sure that, you know, this is where the problem is going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And, like, we don't know, like, what people are doing on these things and, like, who's accessing all these, you know, services. I actually, you know, I mean, I would challenge Facebook to actually, how about just, you know, getting one, if you want to do good for the planet, how about having one, you know, clean source of water for, like, every 10,000 people they want to give access.
Well, maybe they're doing that too.
No, they're not. That's the thing is.
Well, Mark's given away his fortune. I mean, maybe.
Well, technically not. No. I mean, what he's done is he's created an LLC, which he has said will make charitable contributions.
Well.
But he hasn't actually said that he will make charitable contributions. And Bill Gates raised exactly this point. When the whole internet thing from Facebook was announced, he said, look, if you got a choice between having internet access and having clean drinking water or the power to run the device, which one are you going to pick?
Well, I'll choose clean water, of course.
So
that's
I mean,
a fundamental, but it Facebook doesn't have to be an either or. I mean,
Facebook is dressing this up as this is big philanthropic.
Would it be okay if
doing.
We didn't call it internet? If we called it something else?
It's called it basically. We want more people to use Facebook, but it's not really a very catchy title. I mean, it's.
Well, but what's wrong with that? That's their business. Don't I mean?
One thing that I thought was really interesting in Jesse Hempel at Wired wrote a big feature on this topic last week, and the one thing that. The challenge that she said that they're having, aside from especially in India, like a lot of the pushback that they're having from local people who are saying, we don't want your version of the internet, is that in a lot of remote places, people just don't see the point of Wi-Fi. They already have phones, they have their data plans, and they don't understand why they would need to sign up for Facebook's Wi-Fi. And so their challenge is actually adoption. So while we're all freaking out about this now and saying, oh, Facebook is horrible for trying to control the internet, in the end, maybe it won't be a problem because people won't use it.
In India, it's very controversial, I understand. And in fact, the Indian Telecom Regulatory Authority pulled the plug on internet.org while it debates whether telecom operators should be allowed to offer different services with variable pricing or whether net neutrality should be enforced. Mark Zuckerberg's response was to write a piece for the Times of India, buy billboards, newspaper ads, a television campaign to promote free basics. Couldn't you say that, well, this is just anti-competitive malarkey from the Indian regulatory body? If they want to do something, why don't they step up and do something different?
Dude, they have created so much competition in the marketplace, right? There's seven... mobile companies there who are competing in the marketplace much more ruthlessly than we have here in the United States. So I think, you know, will you say the same thing about the FCC? The malarkey is what FCC does is malarkey.
Well, it remains to be seen.
Right.
So if they do what they say they're going to do, it's not malarkey.
I think what the point here is that if they want more people to connect to Facebook, that's fine. You know, they want to subsidize it, that's fine. I can't argue against that. Look at, you know, T-Mobile is banning access to YouTube. I mean, that's no different than right. What Facebook wants to do. I'm perfectly fine with that. They want to pay telcos to subsidize access to Facebook on people's phones, fine. Like, that's an application whose usage is subsidized by Facebook, great. But don't dress it up as the internet. Don't dress it up as you're doing great for the planet. You're doing this for making more money. I'm fine with that. Like, there is nothing wrong with this being a for-profit venture.
Just don't pretend it's charity.
Yeah, just don't pretend that you have. Rub. Yeah, it is. You know, it is unfortunate that it's become like this kind of a debate. I think I'm perfectly fine with Facebook doing what it does for its own shareholders. That's their job. But, you know, don't expect us to kind of buy into it. I definitely have issues with that.
Call a spade a spade. Actually, I'm quoting from an article in the Register by Professor Mark Graham at the Oxford University Internet Institute. He likens Facebook's giveaway to Nestle's free baby formula giveaway in the 70s.
Yeah, that's kind of controversial.
That's a little far.
Yeah, you don't actually, Nestle actually inadvertently or overtly killed people with that giveaway. But when it comes to this is slightly less serious. But
it might not be a bad analogy, though, because it's one of those things where you could say, Nestle could say, no, look, we just want to make sure babies are properly, proper nutrition. We're giving a free formula to people who are very poor, who maybe wouldn't otherwise have access to this. And what they don't mention, of course, is it's not a good alternative to breastfeeding. It's not. It hooks them on this product.
Yeah. Also, they would give away just enough baby food to
first one's free baby
to basically ensure that the mothers stopped nursing. They lost their milk, and then they had to go to Nestle, and then the prices got jacked up, and that's why so many people died. In this case, it's not a life or death situation.
Not quite that bad.
No, but I can see why, from an internet rights perspective, it gets people really riled up because you are basically subscribing to the gatekeeper model, the walled garden, and whatever Facebook likes goes on there. Whatever they don't like doesn't. So I find it very worrying, and I do find it really annoying that they dress up as a philanthropic activity as opposed to, we just really want to widen our footprint in what's going to be a very key market.
Mark Zuckerberg.
But I'm curious though, because Mark Zuckerberg is just like so sincere in
the way that he feels to me. Yeah.
And the way that he talks about this and it acts like he just really wants to help. And why don't people want his help? And I don't know if that's like just naivete and kind of Silicon Valley drinking the Kool-Aid, or if it's like, I'm really tricking them. They really think I want to help and we're going to make so much money. Like, I can't really tell which one it is. So I'm curious what you guys think.
Well, it's one of the reasons I'm raising this, also because Ohm says we don't cover it enough, so I want to cover it and give you all a chance to speak out about it. Mark Zuckerberg, writing in the Times of India, says, what reason is there for denying people free access to vital services for communication, education, health care, employment, farming, and women's rights? I think that's a legitimate question, and I want to hear what you guys, how you guys answer that. But I think you've done so, Ohm. I think there is a kind of anti-corporate point of view in some parts of the world, less so in the U.S., but in other parts of the world where
it's not anti-corporate point of view. I think what it is not, he's not being straight when he talks about this. So if he wants cleaner, like people should have more communication, yes, then they should use everything from WhatsApp to Kick to WeChat. Whatever is out there, not just Facebook-approved messaging service, not Facebook-approved. If he wants to subsidize people's internet access, then they should have access to all the internet, not just Facebook-approved internet.
What if somebody created a library that wasn't public? It was a commercial enterprise. They chose the books, but it is a library. It was a lending library, free library. Would that be okay?
Well, there is the argument that some information is better than none, certainly.
That's my argument.
But on the other hand, the whole point of the internet is that it's an open platform with access to all the information that's on there. And if you're going to say, well, we'll give you this little bit of this little chunk of it, and by the way, that includes a large part of our own services as well.
Although there's no requirement that you use Facebook to do this, right?
No, there's no requirement that you use Facebook, but let's face it, if somebody's given you this free thing, you're going to check it out to see what's there.
Yeah, well, Facebook's pretty good. I think it'd be a reasonable thing for Mark to say, hey, if they have access to it, they might use it. I bet a lot of them will.
Yeah, but it might also be better if Facebook...
How harmful is it, though, if people use Facebook? That's not the end of the world.
No, it's not the end of the world. All I'm saying is, if you want to be strictly fair about it, Facebook could pay their taxes in these countries and other countries and actually give the government the revenue to run
the
stuff
out
themselves.
Are they not paying taxes in...
Facebook's pretty bad. I mean, Google's just reached a deal this week with the UK tax authorities whereby they're paying £130 million pounds in tax.
That's
an effective tax rate of 2.5%.
Yeah.
Facebook, I think it was Facebook last year in the UK, paid $4,000 in £4,000 in corporation tax because they'd shifted things through to other subsidiaries. So I'd take these kind of campaigns a lot more seriously if the companies involved actually paid their taxes to let government do it in an equal-handed way, as opposed to just following their personal corporate agendas.
Mark says, who could possibly be against this? And I feel like he's sincere. Or do you think he's not sincere when he says, how could you be against this?
It's a nice line. Can't argue against that line, but I don't buy it.
I love the conversation. We'll table it. And by the way, just in case you're wondering, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here.
But I think what Mark asks is legitimate.
And I want to know why it's such a bad idea. So I think you've all done a good job of saying it.
And one thing I would also point out is that Om is right that it really hasn't been covered as much as maybe it should be. But in the last week, there were two really good in-depth deep dives into this. And there was one on BuzzFeed that, you know, if anyone's interested in, they should definitely check out because it does take a more critical angle looking at this.
I wish BuzzFeed... I want to read and like BuzzFeed as a journalistic enterprise, but I
just, you should.
I know because and there's great and many of my friends work there and they do great stuff.
I'm sure I'm about to hear what's stopping you from doing that
because it feels like it's BuzzFeed.
it takes a bit of a while to get away from that. Number four will shock you.
Yeah,
kind of thing, you know.
You do know that the New York Times has a style section that writes some of the most ridiculous stories.
I agree,
on the internet,
but it's the style section.
Right. Maybe it's BuzzFeed's life section.
But that's how BuzzFeed started, right? I mean,
yeah.
If they had started as a journalistic enterprise that and added, you know, a link bait section, that'd be different.
Then everyone would say BuzzFeed's going downhill. Look at all the link bait started doing.
Yeah. They wouldn't have much traffic. Also,
they wouldn't have any traffic. That's the problem. Yeah,
it's worth pointing out. Yeah, that they can finance all kinds of investigative journalism where their writers don't have to churn out three stories a day, but can spend several days digging into something because it's all supported by, you know, cat gifts and food videos on Facebook.
I'm an old man. I'm just old fashioned. I don't know why. This is, by the way, you know, the 20th anniversary was Friday of the first New York Times website.
Yeah, beginners. Honestly, we've been online since '94. For goodness' sake,
really?
I was trying to beat them
by two whole years.
Yeah, I know. But you know, it's just like I love this idea. Like 20 years ago, we took this brave step forward. And it's like, yeah, after other people had kind of got there first, but you know, good on them.
It was kind of a funky looking site in those days, I must say.
It was always fun getting on the Wayback Machine and seeing how these things look because it's just.
I actually didn't think it looked all that much different than their site today. They still, I mean, the logo is the same, the layout is the same, the image
the
is
font
the same
is still
place.
Times New Roman, yes. you know what I found interesting in the upper left hand corner? I'll see if I can find it. In the upper left hand corner is an ad for auto classifieds.
Oh, bless.
That just showed that it came from a different era, right?
That was a billion-dollar company now, not owned by the Times.
That was before Craigslist almost put them out of business. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. Om Malik is here from Om.co. What do I call you, Om? Angel investor?
No, I am a professional venture capitalist.
A professional venture capitalist.
I'm a partner at True Ventures, and all I do is invest in.
So you're not an angel. You're like the real deal.
Do I look like an angel?
None of this. I'll write you a check for $5,000. Give me half your company. None of that stuff.
No.
I want to talk about unicorns then in a little bit.
I think Erin is more,
She's got the URL.
She has the URL. So I'm just going to listen what she has to say.
Fortune.com/unicorn tears, Erin Griffith. She's also here. And from the register.co.uk, who has been doing it for two more years than the New York Times.
Well, you know, we've got to blow our own trumpet sometimes.
Great to have all three of you. Our show today brought to you by audible.com. I'm going to try not to do it a five-hour Audible ad. It would be easy for me to do because I'm such a fan. I've been an Audible member since 2000. I had a long commute. I used to get books on tape. You'd get them in a box of like 20 tapes. You'd have 1 month to listen to them, and you'd have to send the box back. It was not the best way to do it, but I fell in love with audiobooks at that time. And then along comes this little startup, audible.com, and they send you out this hardware device that you can listen to books on. Eventually I put it on my Diamond Rio, and lo and behold, here we are 16 years later, and I've had 500 books. In fact, I can go to my Audible site and still see my entire library from the I know what my very first book was, I know what my most recent book is. And I'll tell you, when you look at this, they've come such a long way, 180,000 titles now. There isn't a bestseller that doesn't come out on Audible at the same time as it hits the bookstores. And the readers are so good. The stuff is so compelling. And it's not just books. I mean, they have the great courses too, the best college professors teaching college-level courses. Here's Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution, Modern Physics for Non-Scientists, 12 hours, 24 lectures. It's food for your brain. And you can get this and another book free. You get this and the Dorito Effect, the surprising new truth about food and flavor. Okay. I like books like that too, right? Yeah. But I also love the fiction here. There's so much great fiction on Audible.
And some Harry Potter, I see.
The whole thing. Now, you guys in the UK, Audible UK has Stephen Fry reading the Harry
Potter.
Yeah,
he does have a marvelous voice.
He's wonderful. But here in the States, we have another guy named Jim Dale. And there's a real schism between the Fries and the Dales, over Fry and over Dale. Jim Dale does all the really goes into the voices. Stephen Fry's too big a star to really do, you know.
Well, I mean, he's a classically trained actor.
Don't talk like this. So here's a little Jim Dale. Everything, by the way, that Jim Dale reads sounds like it's extremely urgent.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in
I think this version, the American version, is more British than the British version.
Yeah, I can see your point. It's just, I never found Harry Potter believable. I mean, a guy with red hair in a boarding school with two friends, it's never going to happen.
And not to mention a lightning mark on his forehead.
Yeah.
Anyway, Audible is a great place if you've not read Harry Potter. See, what's great about this is, you could do this with the kids. There's lots of young adult books on here, but this is a good one that you could listen to with your family in the car going on a road trip. Audible saves you. It saves you from road trips. It saves you from commuting. It saves you from the boredom, the tedium of the treadmill. It is amazing. There's lots of politics on here, too. I mean, this is going to be a great year to catch up. And if you love the X-Files, are coming back tonight. You can read some of the novelizations from the X-Files. Here's the deal. I'm going to get you two books. This is the challenge. Pick two. This is the Alexander Hamilton book that the Broadway show was based on. There's no singing in this, though.
So a Broadway show based on Alexander Hamilton.
You don't know about Hamilton?
Was this the guy who killed people in duels?
Yeah, and it's a rap version. And it's the hit on Broadway. You don't know about Hamilton? Oh,
no.
Have you seen it yet, Aaron?
No.
I know. What land is he from?
What internet are you on?
Yeah, Hamilton's awesome.
How have you not heard about this? It's
anyway,
a phenomenon.
We'll fill him in on Hamilton. We'll get him up with speed on Hamilton.
You should at least be listening to it on Spotify.
Absolutely.
The soundtrack's
really good. Start with the book. You get two of them by going to audible.com/twit2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum Plan. That means two free audiobooks in a month. You also get the Daily Digest, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. And you can cancel any time in the first 30 days. Pay nothing. But that'll be a book. Those two books will be yours to keep. Little Robert Heinlein would be great. They have great science fiction on here. I'm really. Ooh, there's a new William Gibson. No one. Why didn't you tell me? I said to no one in particular. Awesome.
I hope he's managed to work out how to do endings now.
I don't care. It's so good until it ends. Who cares?
Yeah.
One of my favorite. The guy really who put cyberpunk on the map.
I'm on my fourth copy of Neuromancer, and I lend it out to people.
Must
and
listen.
I never get it back.
New William Gibson. It's called The Peripheral. I'm signing in my Audible account right now to download it. That's what's so cool. You're going to love Audible. Audible.com/twit2. Your first two books are free. Get them right now. See, I have a credit.
Sweet.
So I got it for free because I subscribe.
I'm going to say Audible books are invaluable on long commutes. It just takes an awful lot of the pain out of it.
Flights, travel. So I can think of 100 reasons. I do it on my Amazon Echo. I can say, read to me. I say, Echo, read to me, and it starts reading me my book. So I'm washing the dishes. I'm cooking dinner. I'm listening all the time.
Okay. I was going to say, if you do that on public transport, I might have to kill you. But
no. I listen to it with headphones on public transport. Audible.com/twit2. I just bought the Peripheral, the new William Gibson. It was that easy. 20 years of the New York Times. Do you feel like the New York Times has turned the digital corner? Or are they like Kodak, just hanging on to an inevitable end?
Wait, isn't there data that can answer this question for us rather than going by feelings?
I think there is data. Like some
facts.
Some numbers. Recently published, right?
I am not up on it, unfortunately.
I think they have a million. Trying to remember. Let's see.
They have over a million.
Million digital subscribers.
Digital subscribers. But I don't know if that means more revenue than print. There was a report this week that showed the decline of newspaper subscriptions, and it was very ugly.
So I love this number. The New York Times has a million digital-only subscribers, 1.1 million print and digital subscribers.
Hang on.
Do us some subtraction.
Yeah, that means there's not many people subscribing to the print version. Yeah.
Oopsies.
Also, you can kind of understand it, because Sunday's New York Times, when it arrives, you can break your foot with that thing.
I know. I love it. That's what I do, is I subscribe to the Sunday Times, and then I get the digital part of that. But it's more than $100 a year for the digital subscription. So it's more than $100 million a year in revenue. I don't know if that's more than before. I mean, you've lost all of that classified ad revenue. The display ad revenue when you get digital is probably not very good.
And I mean, I know the newsroom has been through some fairly savage cuts, but they're still employing a lot of journalists to go out there and get the news. But I don't know. I mean,
The Times executive editor, Dean Beckett. We employ as many reporters as we did 15 years ago. And in fact, we've swollen our ranks with... See, I would just write around that one and pick another word.
Yeah.
But this is audio, and I can't. Graphics editors, developers, video journalists, other digital people to do things like... what was that one with the snow and the...
Snowfall.
Mm. That was awesome.
3 years ago, can't stop talking about it.
Really? Is it that long?
I think it was like...
Wow.
My God, time flies by when you're having fun. It's just...
57 million monthly uniques. Now, that sounds like a lot, but it's got to be... What's BuzzFeed? It's probably 10 times
200.
That. 200 million. Four times
200.
That.
Yeah.
Gosh, it seems bad when BuzzFeed is beating the New York Times.
All clicks are not the same.
Ah, yes.
Wise words.
And then the Times started this new enhanced subscription thing, Times Insider. I don't know if I'd be curious how well that's done. That's an additional $8 a month.
Yeah, The Guardian's doing something along those lines as well, and I'm curious to see how it works out for them, because it's a really tough job converting clicks into money these days, and particularly if you're a national newspaper like the Times.
It's an international newspaper. I don't think it's a national paper. I think the Times is definitely...
Just a left and right coast paper?
What's wrong with that?
As somebody here on the left coast, nothing.
No, I mean, I'd assumed it had got fairly sort of nationwide subscription.
I think of it as a national
levels,
paper. It's not...
I think it's an international paper. It's
yes.
a paper which is navigating the transition from what it was to what it wants to be more effectively than most people. You know, is it perfect? Probably not. I think if you really had to decide today, what are the papers you will pay for, right? The Wall Street Journal and New York Times will be the two names which will be on pretty much everyone's shortlist. Like, I pay for 5 publications right now. I pay for the Times, print, because I get digital free with it. I pay for the Wall Street Journal because I get digital free with it. I pay for The Economist because I get digital free for it. And I pay for The New Yorker because I actually love The New Yorker. And the fifth publication is Fast Company because, again, I love the publication. So this is like, you know, we have a choice to make. If there was no print publication today of The Times, I would still pay for the digital version. I think they have a brand and the quality and the strength to withstand the shift. You know, you could never make me pay for USA Today or or Washington Post or
not the Washington Post. That's interesting.
Or not even the SF Chronicle or anything. Yeah. Right? Just
no. I'm with you. The Times is the only one I pay for of that bunch.
So I think, you know, we kind of underestimate the challenge of going from the past into the future, but they have made much better efforts than most people. You know, Washington Post essentially had to, you know, go out of business in one sense of a word, and then find a benefactor like, you know, Jeff Bezos, and then, you know, start a climb back into relevance. I think that is, I hate on the Times a lot, but I also have a lot of respect for the kind of journalism they do and the kind of efforts they're making to transition out of the print-only world. I think that the challenge for them is how do they deal with the pension plans they have and all the plants they own and all the nonsense, which the legacy nonsense they have in the business. I think a million subscriptions, how many other publications can say they have a million subscribers?
That's a pretty good number.
Yeah. It's like, you know, they're making almost $500 million or plus in revenues from online. I mean, that's way more than our friends at BuzzFeed are, even though they have more to.
And Amazon is looking, of course, Bezos is, it's not Amazon, it's his own personal investment, but he's looking very hard at beating the New York Times. In fact, to the point where Amazon's giving Prime members quite a deal on the Washington Post, but I still don't think it's come close to a million subscribers. I don't know. I'll have to check the numbers.
You know, so having been in the business for a long time, I would say, you look at what BuzzFeed is doing. BuzzFeed is building the traffic and then backing into the good journalism, right? Whereas the New York Times has the brand.
That's a good way to put it.
And they are basically using that brand and they continue to do what is good journalism. I think that is the key thing. It's like most of the publishers do not understand that, you know, clickbaity things can only be great for a little while. In the end, you're in the business of serving your readers, and you do that by bringing great journalism. That is, you know, that's exactly what Washington Post is doing. That is exactly what New York Times is doing. And that's exactly is what, you know, even BuzzFeed is doing.
Chris Hughes is doing. Oh, no, sorry, never mind.
What on the New Republic was that? So. Yeah,
Facebook, one of the Facebook founders, Chris Hughes, of course, bought and trashed the New Republic. And now he's just trying to sell.
Yeah, he's now
selling
it.
Anybody want it? This is
that magazine has to just go away.
Like, it's a great magazine. No, I love it.
Come on, like nobody cares.
I guess
if
not.
If it was so great, people would be buying it by the truckload, right? Nobody does buy it by the truckload.
No, because it's inside the beltway kind of a. It's an insider.
It's a nonsense, you know, publication which doesn't really have anything much to say, which is relevant to the real America.
There's a risk though to this because what you're seeing with something we thought the internet would fix, which is a consolidation of voices. You want the New Republic and the Washington Monthly to exist, as well as the New Yorker, as well as the New York Times, as well as the Washington Post. But it doesn't look like there's enough room for all of those.
There's room for them. The problem is that they wanted to exist as they always have without changing, without adapting to.
Well, that's what Chris Hughes was trying to do. He was trying to make it a digital product.
Yeah, but he went around it in such a cack-handed way. I mean, basically.
I don't know if that. His staff quit on him. That was the problem.
Over our dead bodies.
The temper tantrums were too much. Yeah. I think, first of all, that whole news cycle was the first time most young people had ever even heard of the New Republic.
I know.
Because all of the people on the internet are suddenly freaking out over it.
Right.
But I think it also was just one of those moments where you're like, oh, right. What's going
on? I thought Ohm would be defending it as a man of some stature and age.
You should read my piece on I have very, very little time and patience for the East Coast media establishment. I think it's very, they are so orthodox and They miss the bigger story.
Well, I went to Yale, you know, so we like to keep it the family. So
wait, what was the bigger story that they missed, though?
I think, you know, most of the time people, like, wait, there is a reason why the publication like New Republic isn't really getting any readers. It's like they don't have anything relevant to say to people who want to read that stuff. The world is different. Like the world gets its information, you know, information on the internet now. So I think, you know, Chris was making a great effort to give some, you know, life to this, you know, this patient, which has been in coma forever. They have not made money in close to 20 years. It's like Uso, Marty Perez said that there's been, like, he's never made money on, when he owned it, he never earned a profit on that business. So any business which is like not making profit, not really being read, why do they exist? And I think this is a huge challenge. I think my argument on this is actually, I wrote a post called The Journalistic Orthodoxy, which is on my blog. So it'll plug there. So.
I got to say.
Why would you be so reluctant? I mean, that's the only reason people are here is to plug things.
Really? I may have to hang with you.
I'm going to read this, though. This you wrote this about a week ago. And there is a, there is absolutely, you know, a journalistic establishment and an orthodoxy. But there's a bubble in Silicon Valley, too. I mean, bubbles exist. There's the Beltway bubble. There's the East Coast kind of Ivy League bubble. There's the Silicon Valley bubble.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really get the argument that just because journalism has to make a profit in order to be worthwhile to do. I mean, look at The Guardian in the UK. That's been run under a trust. It doesn't make a lot of money. It loses a fair amount sometimes. It produces some of the best journalism you'll see
out
there.
You have a tradition, though, in the UK of government-supported, because of the BBC.
Well, we have the BBC, which is kind of different. The BBC, as part of its remit, has to inform the populace.
And is paid for by license.
It's paid for by license fees.
Where does the Guardian Trust come from?
The Guardian Trust is simply a bunch of people who set up a charitable trust to support the Guardian.
So it's like Jeff Bezos in the Washington Post.
Yeah, similar. It's a non-directory.
I know Jeff thinks he's going to make money. Great picture, though, of Jeff flying his reporter, Jason Rezaian, who was, of course, held hostage or held in jail. Depends on how you define hostage. By Iran in July 2014 and was finally released after some serious negotiations. Bezos flew his private jet to Iran to pick him up. And I think that's classy. I think that's cool. That shows a commitment, right? He could have sent a drone to pick him up, but no, he came himself.
They haven't gotten quite that big
not
yet.
That big. Yeah.
Interesting, he was one of the people he was exchanged for was an Iranian hacker who'd hacked into, I think it's Arrow Defense Systems over in Virginia. Picked up in Turkey, extradited over here last year, and this guy's now been sent back to Iran with a full pardon as part of the hostage exchange.
Yeah, but we know who to look for now.
Well, yeah, he obviously couldn't have been that good if they picked him up that quickly, but, right. You know.
Give him the bad hackers. That's okay.
Yeah, we'll keep the good ones.
They can have all the bad hackers.
Push off.
It's a conversation we have a lot on Twig as well with Jeff Jarvis. I think, though, we all agree that we need a variety of journalistic voices, including some kind of, you know, semi not for profit voices, right? Or a profit shouldn't be the sole motive.
The problem is, do we want those non profit voices to be backed by billionaires?
Right. Well, who else?
Like one person who may or may not have an agenda and right. may or may not make it clear what their influence is on those voices. Versus a trust or, you know, a group of
We have of systems backers. Now, thanks to the internet. We have things like Patreon. So we have systems for that kind of backing. I think the problem is that while we all make a big noise about how much we want journalism, nobody's willing to foot the bill, including individuals.
Yeah, unfortunately, people have got far too used to getting their news for free and not realizing that it does cost money. I mean, you can run an advertising-funded internet publication perfectly profitably. The problem comes when you've got a whole host of media out there who don't make a profit. And as you rightly point out, who pays the bills for that? And I think there are a fair number of examples where people have taken over. They run these companies as like their private fiefdoms and they expect their personal opinions pushed. And that's ultimately very bad for journalism.
And by the way, I'm enjoying this journalistic orthodoxy, but I think what's happened is there was this period, and you talk about this, where it looked like the promise of the internet would replace could replace voices like the New Republic. It seems that that promise has been, we are disappointed that the internet has not lived up to its promise. Would you not agree on?
I think there is a lot of great stuff you can read on a daily basis. I think just because I think the time for the New Republic has come and gone.
Right.
I think it's just moving
I'll
on.
I'll grant you that.
I think there is new public. Why are we judging BuzzFeed, right? Just because it doesn't fit our idea of what a publication should be, we start judging them. Why? I think there's people who are actually reading it. There has to be a reason why they read it. And so by dismissing BuzzFeed, we are dismissing the actual people who want that kind of content.
I think BuzzFeed. I'll tell you why I don't like it, and maybe it shows you my roots as an establishment elitist. It feels very arriviste. It feels very anxious for your attention.
You had to use that word.
I did. It feels very, well, you know, It feels like it wants your attention, and they're willing to do things kind of, I mean, link bait cheapens you. And yeah, okay, that side's doing real journalism and that side's doing link bait, but it's the same organization. I think it cheapens you, and I don't think that
that's what people say every time there's a new publication. Like I think the people inside BuzzFeed like to make the comparison to CNN and all the ridiculous antics that they threw out there when they first launched, and everybody's like, oh, cable news, this is awful, oh my god. And
well,
like,
it is awful, by the way. It is awful. They're right.
That doesn't mean they haven't also done a lot of great things. I mean, I'm not defending CNN or BuzzFeed, although I think that you would be foolish to dismiss BuzzFeed and the merit of a lot of the journalism they've done. Of course, the stuff that we're scrolling through right now is horrible.
BuzzFeed quiz. How lazy are you being today?
To spend my time watching that, but at the same time, they have reporters in the same places that the New York Times has reporters all around the world, you know, writing about political conflicts, writing stories that are relevant to local people in their languages. I mean, they're basically imitating the New York Times on their news side, and I think it's worth kind of paying attention to that.
Yeah, BuzzFeed just in the UK just broke a big story about professional match fixing and professional tennis playing.
That's huge. By the way, that was a huge story.
Yeah, that was a really
kudos,
big story.
And they are starting to break a lot of news. I like the idea that they're funding it with things like how to turn any cake into a funfetti cake, or 24 hilarious tweets about kids that are way too real for every parent, or 27 surprisingly funny tweets about cats. These are all on the front page today of BuzzFeed.
All right,
the thing is, nobody goes to their news through the homepage of a website anymore. So I find BuzzFeed stories that are relevant to me through social media because I follow the authors and the specific verticals that are useful.
Yeah, Peretti says that we probably shouldn't even have a website. That confuses people.
Some of their most successful verticals now are only on Facebook.
Right.
They have this thing called Tasty that has 30 million fans, and their videos regularly, it's like food videos, and they regularly get 50 million views, which is totally insane. And that doesn't exist on their website at all. It's only on Facebook.
Can I actually point out a handful of headlines on the Register?
Yeah, but come on, this is what we do.
Register has never made any bones about it.
No,
right?
I mean, we do tabloid headlines with proper stories underneath them.
I think Register is a really important technology publication.
I agree.
Oh, well, thank you.
And what they have, you know, any publication who produces a journalist like Kate Metz in my books is pretty damn good. And Ian, who I love to read.
Oh, jeez. Kate is
but this, and this also comes from a British tradition that I think Americans often misunderstand.
Yeah, you see, I mean,
this kind of tattler tradition.
Well, I mean, it's weird. The US and UK are diametrically opposed on this because your newspapers tend to be very, we are the egalitarian, we're going to take a look at both sides of the stories, and your TV stations are rabidly one way or the other.
Right.
Whereas in the UK, the newspapers are rabidly one way or the other, and the TV stations are very straight laced. But also, we have a red top because red tops are tabloids in the UK, and they go for...
That's a signal that a Brit would recognize.
That's why we have a red
top. How interesting.
So, and we deliberately go for tabloid headlines with meaty stories in there. But I'm sorry, you've got to have fun with headlines. I did a story on Friday, just a nice little thing. The US Navy is now doing biofuels in some of its warships, and they're using beef fuel. So the obvious headline is the next Cuban Gristle crisis. And it had to be done, you know?
I don't mind that. I think that's great.
I think, you know, Leo, if you really think about it, what people at BuzzFeed are doing is essentially those headlines are a way to attract attention in an environment where attention is so fractionalized and we are so addicted to the dopamine hits that there is no other way to attract people, right? So those headlines are essentially advertising for what is essentially often a very good story. That is the way of the world right now. Just, we cannot call it clickbait. I think it is just attention grabbing in the 21st century. I think attention grabbing in the 20th century was the New York Post or the London Sun and, you know, the headlines they came up with. So I just feel that, you know, we kind of tend to be very quickly judgmental about the new media formats which come out. And I think that's not really true. The media formats get popular because they reflect how the world around them likes to consume information, right?
Yeah.
Blogs became popular not because blogs were amazing, they were, but it was easier to consume information faster because we had broadband. And I think, and you've seen that progress, and you think we are at a point where I think BuzzFeed is the normal. I think if they don't do it, they will actually lose the battle, in my opinion.
And Jonah Peretti has made no bones about it, that this is the plan, right? Is to kind of subsidize news. And what's interesting, they have attracted some very, very good journalists.
No, I mean, there are some very, very good journalists working at BuzzFeed. But as you say, the bulk of it is financed by, 10 greatest cat videos or... You won't believe the 20 ways you can get objects stuck at your bottom, and there's nothing
it's like
wrong with
selling heroin to support.
Well,
but the good news is
I wouldn't quite go
giving you
that
free needles.
Far, you know, it's kind of. I mean, that's all the Facebook internet org approach.
Okay.
Everybody. A lot of people look at this stuff. I'm perfectly guilty of passing around stuff, to my friends on
Facebook. Don't you feel guilty about it? I mean.
I make sure that it has to be A, very, very good, and B, no one else has actually got hold of it, which is an almost impossible task.
Well, I'm glad you've got some standards.
But, yeah, and also it's been run through Snopes to check that it is actually true. There's
I'm
going to
unfollow you immediately on Facebook. I feel like I guess I'm old, but I also feel like it cheapens us.
What do you mean
bit.
You guess? You don't know.
O'Malik from ohm.co. Do read that article on that journalism. As in fact, I should just read this every single day because I love your stuff.
Why don't you? I can't believe
you. Do you post every day though? You don't post every day.
I try to post once every 2 days.
Dude, every 2 days.
It's not my day job anymore.
No, I know, but it's in your blood, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love the stories to read this weekend. See that I look at every weekend.
I just do that so that you read and
Yeah.
And then you can come back and invite me
you
back.
Need,
to you.
If just can I give you a little tip? Mm. Snappier headlines.
Really?
No, I'm just thinking more link bait. Not instead of saying like rainy Tuesday, like say you won't, there's water coming out of the sky and you won't believe what happens next. That would be people would click it.
Good news for me is that I don't need to make a
you don't care.
No,
that's the best kind of journalism.
I write this just to make myself happy. So if seriously, it's very freeing to not have to think about headlines and traffic and advertising. And
isn't it better?
Oh, it's great.
See, I realize I have a very strongly moralistic kind of streak in me. And I feel like you should, people, I feel like Google, for instance, should just be like a priesthood where they don't have any side businesses. They just want to do the best search that they can because that's a very important thing, and if we had side businesses like YouTube, we'd be tempted to promote them ahead of other people. So they should just focus. Journalists should accept the fact that they're going to live in a garret and get tuberculosis and suffer for their art, but they are journalists and they're it's a higher. I'm joking, but I have that moralistic streak, that feeling that this is important stuff. You don't need to have cat pictures involved.
If someone was ambitious enough to create Google and make it the success it was amid a dozen other successful search engines at the time when it launched, I don't think that their ambitions will be limited
I understand.
Only
of course.
Search.
Of course.
That's a lot to ask.
No, they're extremely, their ambitions basically have no limit. That scares me too.
But you don't like that.
Actually, I don't dislike it because I feel like Larry and Sergey are actually trying to do big things, big important things. They're trying to take their money, as is, by the way, you can make fun of it, Mark Zuckerberg, as is Bill Gates. They're trying to do something important with their money. You know what happens? And Jason Calacanis was talking about this. You make that much money, you start to feel guilty.
Yeah.
And you feel like, I got to do something because this is insane.
And Calacanis has never felt guilty.
I know he's the wrong guy to state that. But
I was going to say, not everyone as well. Somehow, I don't think that Larry Ellison sits there in the middle of the night.
No,
going,
he's
you
not
know
feel
what?
Guilty.
I've got too much money.
He needs
I just
to
think
feel
he thinks
guilty.
Everyone else has got money. Why isn't it in my pocket? You know,
he needs to feel worse about it.
Steve
money.
Jobs was a lousy giver to charity.
He did not feel. Yes, in fact, he shut down all of Apple's charitable efforts.
Yeah,
it wasn't until Tim Cook took over that they reinstated all of that.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, I mean, there are great philanthropists. I mean, Bill Gates, I think Bill was kind of just got sick of being the most hated person in the computing industry and just decided, you know, I've got
That's
all this money.
That's what Andrew Carnegie did. Andrew
exactly.
Carnegie made his money in steel and was, you know, a robber baron, let's yep. face it. So, and his, I think what happens is you start to think about your death
mm-hmm.
and go, you know, crap, I can't leave this behind. So he said, I'll build some libraries.
Yeah.
We have a lovely Carnegie Free Library in Petaluma.
It's oh, you've
beautiful.
Gone here.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'll take you over there after the show. Be fun. We'll have a little walk.
Yeah, the I don't know. I mean, I just found some of Facebook, particularly there's something about Mark Zuckerberg that, you know, he comes out with this pronouncement when his kid was born, when he sort of gave away his money into this limited company. He's doing this the internet.org thing, and it's all just like, well, you know, we're just trying to make the world a better place.
This is
Isn't
my
it
problem.
Wonderful, and it's just like,
this is my
no,
problem.
No, seriously, it's so self-serving.
It comes down to your personal opinion of Mark Zuckerberg. That's what it is that people don't trust Mark.
No, I trust people on their actions. You know, I mean, Gates is actually eradicating polio at the moment. Mark Zuckerberg is
Mark's
giving
young.
It-
Mark's young. He's when Bill Gates was Mark Zuckerberg's age, I promise you, he was not eradicating polio.
No.
He was amassing as big a fortune as he possibly could get.
Yeah. Yes, you,
so
you have a fair
So the fact that here's
that,
a guy in his early 30s who's already said, I'm going to give it all away. And I believe him. Just because he made an LLC out of it, I don't think that – I feel that's unfortunate. As
I think those are two separate things. LLC, what he's giving away with his own money and what he's trying to do with internet.org, those are two absolutely separate issues. On the first one, he's making a choice how he's going to give away the money he's made, and I think one can't be judgmental about it. He didn't say anything, you know, about like the process he's going to use to give away the money. I believe he will give away the money. He will figure out the right way to give away the money. Though I continue, so I will defend him on that side, but I oppose the internet.org. You know, vehemently. Like there is no, like there is. I am not ambiguous about my dislike on the whole internet.org.
And it has nothing to do with animosity towards.
I love Mark Zuckerberg. I think I met him a long time ago in 2004, and from where he was to where he is today, if most of us improved as much as human beings, the world would be a way better place than it is today.
Mm.
He is a remarkable chief executive. He's probably one of the smartest internet thinkers right now. He has all those things, which is why I also have doubts about the internet.org, that it's not a well-planned long-term move on his part, right? So
he's very, very, very smart and strategic.
Very smart. I think he is one of the best tech CEOs. He's way better tech CEO than he has outsmarted Google in pretty much every sense of the word. He has, you know, they were late starters to the mobile, and they have become the biggest beneficiaries of the mobile revolution. They make more strategic moves right than they make the bad ones. And I think that is all because he is still, Mark Zuckerberg, an always improving person.
Mm.
Whereas everybody else is still like, you know, it's like, you know, everybody else is just trying to change the world without really knowing what it means.
Right.
And so, but then, you know, that is one aspect of Mark Zuckerberg. I think the other one is this whole internet.org malarkey, in the words of Ian, and I don't buy that, like not even for 1 minute.
I also think Mark, when he gave, what was it, $100 million to the Newark schools in a very kind of famous failure, learned a lesson and said, well, wait a minute, all right, And Gates himself said that. He says, I'm not going to give away my fortune until I can do it right.
Yeah.
It's hard to do with, you know, you don't want to waste that money.
No, I mean, I agree with Omar. It does come across like there's been a bit of a Zuckerberg hate fest here. And the guy is phenomenally talented in a lot of areas. I just think
why do we think people hate him so much? Why do people hate him so much?
Why do people hate Facebook?
Why do people not trust him?
People hate Facebook, don't they? People use it and hate it. at the same time, I find this very interesting. I'm not talking about regular people. Regular people are probably not that conscious of how they feel about Facebook. It's just a thing. Like, you know, yeah. you know, they don't think I have a feeling about AOL or Gmail or whatever. They just think. But those of us in the business right. really have a strong
somehow,
feelings
I mean,
about
I guess
it.
Because Facebook is such a personal part of people's lives, it's so ingrained. They have your baby photo, you know, your photos of your kids. They know when you broke up with someone, when you start dating somebody. They have all of this stuff. So I guess it's just the personal aspect that people feel like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is in their lives.
Yeah, and with whether they like it or not, and maybe a little too much.
Perhaps.
I don't think, you know, I hate Facebook or Mark Zuckerberg at all. I just disagree with one or two specific right. things they keep doing. I think now I'm a civilian. So I'm just saying I like using the service and whatever. But I think as journalists, when I was a journalist, it was my job to report on
challenge it.
On privacy, on yeah. how they were using our data. That is the job of the media. I mean, you know, there is a reason why I don't get to talk to him. It's because I would ask these questions.
Right.
Right? I mean, if you're a media reporter who's not asking any of the relevant, tough questions, you have access to all the CEOs.
Yeah.
That's how it works now.
Yeah.
This is very Hollywood. This is very much like Beltway. It's not, people don't want to talk about the stuff which actually is important. That is a fact right now. Everybody is actually just doing the, you know, has to, you know, play by the rules and paint within the lines in order to get access to.
That's kind of how we started, and I think that's very true. News is managed. The information is heavily managed now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got to say access journalism over here really is a curse on the profession. There are far too many people out there who are
Why
not prepared.
Why has it not emerged in Britain?
I think because it's the press work together more closely than they over here. Press seem to be very much in competition with each other. I've noticed this in the Bay Area in particular.
So it's divide and conquer.
Yeah, a lot of journalists don't talk to each other. Yeah. They don't share information. Whereas in the UK, it's
us against them.
It's very common. Yeah, just to like yeah. sort of, have you got anywhere on this? Because I'm trying to do this, and you share information. You pull information against a common foe.
Yeah.
Rather over here, certain people. Far too many people will basically just suck up to those in power and in return for
that
access.
Is maybe you may have pinpointed the single biggest change. It's not about the internet or digital. The single biggest change over the last few decades is this going from the notion of we're the fourth estate. We are here to represent the interests of the people against power, against government, to speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. To how can I get clicks? How can I get access? Yeah. How can I get the big interview? And so what if I don't speak truth to power? I want to have that Mark Zuckerberg interview on the front page.
Yeah,
that may be the single, but you may have pinpointed the single biggest change in the last.
I think that's a large part of it. But companies also got wise to the fact that
they're very good
if they cultivate these yeah. particular people, then. They can give them exclusives.
Apple's brilliant at this.
Well, Apple is very good at this, but I mean, there are other companies do it as well. But the concept is, be nice to us, and we will give you exclusives. And these exclusives are just going to be what the company wants to see in print anyway. So it's ultimately for journalism. It's a losing game.
I stopped interviewing CEOs long ago because it was obvious that it was basically an advertisement. I remember Comdex. They said, "Do you want to interview Bill Gates?" I said, "Love to interview Bill Gates." Okay, here's. Submit those questions. Here's the questions you'll be allowed to ask.
Oh, please.
And I said, okay, I'm not interviewing Bill Gates, I guess. There's no point in that.
Yeah.
It becomes, you become a shill for the company.
Exactly.
But now too many people are willing to do that because that's how business is done.
Yeah.
And that maybe that's my problem with BuzzFeed is you can't have it both ways. You can't be the fourth estate. You can't be in opposition to power if you also... have
Wait,
to
are
cultivate
you, what,
clicks.
What, do you have evidence of BuzzFeed?
No,
get access? I don't know.
I just, think that's I have, case. No, you're right. I shouldn't.
I've got to say, the New York Times didn't exactly cover itself with glory.
No, they've not been.
It sat on the wiretapping story for four years just because the U.S. government said, would you mind please just not saying that? It's. Yeah, I mean, there is fault everywhere, and nobody is perfect on this front. But I do think that journalists in particular really got to grow a pair and start asking tough questions.
I think this was business. This is how business is done in Hollywood and in Wall Street and in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's happening in Silicon Valley. I think we are just noticing it a lot more now because it's a more recent phenomenon, last 3 or 4 years. I think so. The last few years of GigaOm, you could actually feel it, because you would not get access to a lot of people because, you know, you were not playing the game. And yep. I think if you don't play the game, you know what? I would rather write my own independent blog than play the game.
Yeah. And that's why you guys had great journalists like Matthew Ingram, and who ended up at a Fortune, most of them.
Right.
Because they were people who still had that mission to tell the truth, to speak truth to power. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. Erin Griffith is here from Fortune magazine. She's, of course, at the very famous URL, fortune.com/unicorntears. We're going to make that number one on Google. When people search for unicorn tears, they're going to get Erin Griffith.
Right. I'll be beating out the results for the they're like purses and iPhone cases you can now get unicorn tears on it. Yeah. So
you're going to be a Snapchat video, a meme, you know, animation any minute now. Tears coming out. Also from the register.co.uk, it's my good friend Ian Thompson, and of course, Om Malik, who you may not be officially a journalist still, but you're still the dean, I think, of tech journalism, and we're really glad to have you. You're the dean emeritus.
Whatever you want to say.
I'll call you anything I want.
Yeah, I know. I can't win.
No, we love you. I love doing this show because the people we get on this show are just so great, and I'm really glad to have all three of you. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting, the way to meet with coworkers and clients without the time and hassle of travel, the money. And nowadays with your clients and your colleagues all over the world, you can't often meet with them in person, but you've got to meet. It's so important. People hate meetings. If you could make meetings more efficient, more effective, you'd do it, wouldn't you? You got to have them because it's the best way to break through the Gordian knot. We have a rule here, more than 3 emails exchanged face-to-face. GoToMeeting makes that easy because you can meet with your team wherever you need to, wherever you are, from any computer, any tablet, any smartphone, no travel expenses, no traffic, no snowmageddon. You can actually present from an iPad sitting out on your back porch. Your team can join just by clicking a link. There's no sign up. They don't have to be GoToMeeting members. No speed bumps. If they don't have the software, it downloads in seconds. They're ready. They join. Turn on their HD webcam. You can see them. Turn on your HD webcam. They can see you. It's like you're in the same room. You could see each other's screen, so you're all on the same page. You got a presentation. You know, this is great for sales pitches, for instance. You got a presentation. You got a PowerPoint. You don't want to make the client jump through hoops. You want to be efficient. You want to get to the point. You want to give the client the information they need, and you can do it fast and easy with GoToMeeting. They'll appreciate it, and you'll do more. I want you to sign up right now. It's free for 30 days. You could do it right now and have your first meeting going in just a minute or two. It's that easy. GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. I want you to try it right now. GoToMeeting. We love it. We don't do a meeting without it. Google Amp. I guess we could stay in the journalistic vein. Google Amp is about to come out of, I don't know what you call it.
Beta.
Mm. Everything at Google is beta. This is Google's attempt to, well, it's got a couple of faces. One, to compete against Apple and Facebook, both of which have their own kind of news story feature. But also, Google, I think, did this because they wanted to speed up the mobile net. And they didn't want people to use ad blockers because that's their business. So they said, look, we can make this a better internet with AMP. Now, it's an open source project. Google says, yeah, we don't control it. And yet, in a way, they do, because if you want to make an AMP page, you have to use JavaScript and tags, not traditional HTML tags, but your own Google-approved tags.
Yes, that does rather make me very nervous about
it. It feels like
thing.
The internet.org to me in some ways. It feels like to me Google saying, look, the internet doesn't work, so let us handle it. And I feel like there's engine. Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm just going to say I think that we should get used to that feeling. Yeah. I think that's going to happen a lot more, especially with the fact that most media companies are, I mean, even including the one that I work for, are not amazing at tech.
Right.
Yeah, it's, I think you're right. We are going to have to get used to it. Doesn't mean we have to like it, though. I mean, there's just...
No, and we should definitely debate it and talk about the challenges and the and what we're giving up when we agree to do Facebook Instant Articles or Google AMP. But ultimately, I imagine that most media companies are going to join it and agree to it and get sucked into it and deal with the consequences later. And then probably in 10 years from now, try to extract themselves from it, similar to the way I'm thinking about, like,
no, you're
so
right.
At the beginning of the internet, like Time Inc., the company that I worked for, you know, we had content, AOL had people, but no content. So they're like, okay, let's just put your content through our portal and we'll control it all. And then, you know, Time spent years trying to extract itself out and build its own website after that. And that feels like this all over again.
Yeah, I think it's a very accurate summation of the situation that we're in at the moment. I mean, Facebook has its own news service, their own news service that they floated end of last year as well. As you, I think you're right. It's increasingly people are trying to command the portals now, and I don't think it's good for journalism.
It started with the app economy, where people stopped using the free and open web and started moving everything into apps. And I can understand. I mean, that's the same argument. If you're the Wall Street Journal, you'd rather people read the Wall Street Journal in the Wall Street Journal app, right? Or maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because sure. You control the experience.
Yeah. You can gather much more data.
Yeah.
Sure. It's faster. They can actually track people. There's not really a good cookie system set up on the mobile web.
You don't want people wandering around the internet. They could get into trouble. You want to keep them in a nice, safe place. What do you think about AMP?
Well, I have to first disclose that I'm an investor in a company which provides similar technology to companies who want to speed up their experience. And so, you know, if people want to use Google or Facebook, that's up to them. But there are real world solutions. The company is called Twin Prime, and I believe the problem with the actual content delivery on the mobile is a very real problem. And it's not just about ad blocking. I think ad blocking was actually consumers saying that we will not be, you know, abused by the publications and by the ad networks more than anything else.
Doc Searles calls it the largest boycott in the history of the internet. Right. People are boycotting advertising. I think that's actually a really interesting way to put it.
Right. But if you really think about whether it is the Facebook Instant Articles or Google AMA and some of the technology we at Twin Prime have, is that people want faster access to information on the mobile. The kind of latency they expect on desktop, they want on mobile as well. And the mobile sites are not really built like that. There is just too much, you know, clutter, too much JavaScript, too much nonsense.
There are pages I cannot read on my smartphone because of the takeovers.
But even the networks themselves are not very great, right? Like, I think there is just one aspect is the actual websites, but then when the app economy, the performance suffers because the networks are not as, you know, optimal. So I think all this is pointing to a direction where we need better ways of offering, you know, access to information. And I think technology companies are out there. I wish the media companies would take a step back and say, can we do this independently? Can we use vendors who are actually trying to make these technologies and not get sucked into Facebook and Google's silos? That's a question media companies need to ask. And I think that's where it all boils down to. It's like, how much are they willing to try independent things, or how much they want to just get sucked into, you know, those two worlds and just kind of say, oh, well, you know, they're going to pay for everything and we're just going to go for it. I think Dave Weiner is writing some of the best stuff around this issue right now, in my opinion. You should, and everybody should read his blog.
Scripting.com.
Yeah. And, like, he's been pointing out the challenges of being locked into the silos we have emerging on the internet. So I don't know. I mean, I just feel that we need to be very careful. When I say we, I mean media companies. I don't know why I keep saying we. It's like,
because you can't. It's a habit.
I know. Can't. I know.
Once a journalist, always a journalist. No, you know, no, the rules. No. You know,
that's it. I am not sure I want to go that far.
Well, you're a journalist for this. The couple hours you're on this show now. No. Sorry.
But it would be good to. You know what I would love to know is about the Unicorn Tears URL. How did that come about?
I started a column in the magazine, and they wanted a shortcut to it. And the column is called Boom with a View, and so they created fortune.com/boom. And once I realized we had that functionality, I...
What else can you do with this internet thing?
Tech request for other ones, and that was the only one that got approved.
Well, Boom works too, so we could use Boom if you want something a little bit shorter.
You know, one thing that I was thinking when you mentioned that this was the biggest boycott on the internet, I actually think the fact that nobody's subscribing, people have been boycotting subscriptions on the internet since pretty much the beginning of the internet.
And now we don't want ads either.
Right, exactly. People,
you don't want a paywall, you don't want an ad. What do you want?
Right.
Everything free.
Everything free.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of unfortunate that we're here, but
I don't know.
It's too late.
I was speaking to an analyst, and he was actually saying something quite comforting, which was that people are actually getting smarter about their ad block use now, in that if they like a publication, they will take it off their ad block list, provided the ads themselves aren't too pushy.
Right.
And I think
that's
this
so generous of them. Wow.
Well, you know, a lot of companies still make serious money from advertising.
I'm going to do this just for you. I've gone into my ad blocker. I am at fortune.com/unicorntears. Disable the ad blocker. I am going to see the 25 ads, apparently, and the 20 out of 32 domains that are connected on this page. Yeah. Bring it on.
It's very slow also, and this is why. And we've gone back and forth for a long time of how to speed up our site. And it's like, oh, well, we have to have that. You see that line across the top that has all the presentations at Time Inc. We have to load that. And we have to have Outbrain at the bottom. And we have to have all these ads. And so... It's kind of, we've kind of dug our own grave before we've even started. And I'm not the one who makes these decisions and who's in control of stuff.
Yeah.
But I can, tell you as somebody who loads fortune.com a lot that it is frustrating.
You don't use an ad blocker?
I don't.
You wouldn't be able, you, it would be
I'm
kind
not
of.
Necessarily, I'm not necessarily morally opposed to it because I think that internet ads are pretty awful.
Yeah.
But I just don't, maybe out of laziness or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'd got to say, I agree with you 100% on the point, Aaron, that far too many websites, and I think everyone's been guilty of this, have these ridiculous adverts, which full screen pop ups or autoplay video, take your pick. And it just drives people off and drives people into the hands of ad blockers. And that's perfectly understandable because nobody wants, a website which takes the piss on this. But,
And it's a data suck, too. That months ago that talked about how much actually in dollars and cents in your data plan certain websites are costing you. It really makes it realistic.
I love Matthew Ingram, and I bet he got in a little bit of trouble writing this on his Fortune site. You shouldn't feel bad about using an ad blocker, and here's why.
Yeah, I'm sure he got a stern email about that one.
No, I'm sure he didn't. I don't think Fortune would do that. I don't know. You work for him. I don't know.
I haven't gotten any email.
I think they'd be smart enough not to say anything about that. Was it?
Yeah, but it is really interesting to watch. So the the IAB, which is the kind of in charge of this industry group that regulates, but tries to basically unify internet ads and make them all the same and make them easier to buy. And they're sort of like the voice of digital advertising. They're having a real existential crisis over the ad blocker thing.
Right.
They had a conference last fall and they invited some people that are kind of like running small websites that making their livelihood off of these websites and that have been, seriously affected by ad blockers. And they kind of had them testify as to how much it's hurt their business and how can we help them and how can we save them from ad blocking. And it was just really ironic because we're sitting here and it's like, well, you guys are the problem. You've created a crappy product that people hate so much that they're willing to download a specific tool to avoid it. And these are internet users who are pretty lazy and, you know, don't like to pay for things. So I feel like they have so much soul searching to do when it comes to making ads less awful.
I have to be honest also, even before I started using an ad blocker, I didn't see those ads. I almost tuned them out intentionally.
Right.
So I wonder how effective
they are. Now it's a matter of speed. Although sometimes there's ones that are just flashing, right?
Well, that's why they look like that, right? Because I wasn't paying attention. It's my fault.
Well, I mean, you forget also with a lot of the main ad blocker products, adverts do still get through. Companies can pay the ad blocking company to allow their adverts
to
through.
The one I use.
No, I mean, if
but AdBlock, you're right.
Yeah,
that's exactly AdBlock
does. That is their
AdBlock
Plus,
I'm sorry.
Yes,
yeah.
That's their business model in that if you have what they call approved advertising, which isn't too intrusive, you can pay them some money and they'll let that through. And I think that's rather disingenuous.
That's extortion. That's total extortion.
You know, I had the guys from AdBlock Plus on. We did an interview with them and we talked a lot about I can't remember, the approved ads program. And I think they defended it fairly well, saying, look, we have guidelines. You have to follow the guidelines. You can't just give us money. You have to have ads that don't jump out at you. They don't have JavaScript. There's some reasonable guidelines. And I do think it's appropriate to say, the black and white, no ads versus ads, isn't really enough. And I think it's reasonable to say there are ads. You know, I go to Daring Fireball, John Gruber's site. He's one of those small bloggers who is probably hurt by ad blockers. And he's got one ad on a page. It's a text ad. It's harmless.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a reasonable kind of middle ground where you say, well, maybe we could allow decent, you know, small, unobtrusive ads through and still support those sites. I pay for Google Contributor, and one of the nice things about that, by the way, that's bigger and bigger all the time. More and more sites I see the contributor blocks on. You could pay up to $10 a month. That's the maximum. And then sites that are somehow opt into this, you won't see any more ads on them. No Google ads anyway on it. And I have to disable my ad.
And
blocker.
Then they split all that revenue with the participating sites.
Well, I don't know if it's all that revenue. I wonder. It's Google after
all.
Yeah. Well, some of that revenue. I don't know.
Enough to make it interesting.
A lot of sites use it.
One company that is not freaking out over ad blocking is our favorite company, BuzzFeed, because all of their ads are native. They look just like the content that you're consuming everywhere. And they can, I mean, they're kind of genius in this way. They can have a cooking show and then just have a product placement or an ad in it at the beginning of their video or at the end. And they don't have to deal with Facebook. They don't have to deal with Google. They don't have to deal with any ad network whatsoever. They're kind of in control of their own destiny there, which I think is kind of smart.
Yeah, but that's the negative. Another negative side effect is native content, where it's a content posing.
That's its own
ads
own
posing
debate.
As content.
Yeah, that's own debate. But they at least kind of own their situation, and they don't have to worry about people blocking their ads.
So I've turned off my ad blocker, and what I did with Contributor is I said show a kitty cat wherever there would be an ad.
Yeah.
So now here on Recode, and at first you might think Recode really likes cats. But in fact, that would be an ad. But Google Contributor, because I pay them some money, is going to give some money to Recode and put a kitty cat on the page.
Yeah, I mean, there are plugins. I think there used to be a plugin for Mozilla, which would, every time, there's a British tabloid called the Daily Mail, every time you clicked on a Daily Mail link, it would direct you through to a picture of a kitten, because that was much better for your brain than actually trawling through a Daily Mail article.
Yeah, so, I'm sure Recode is appreciating that, like, 5-cent check that they're getting
every
month.
Well, maybe that's, that's more. Maybe they're making more than they would be from that. I don't know. But, I mean, those ads, the cost on these is very low now because nobody looks at them. They don't click on them.
It's not a good business anyway. So that's kind of what the ad industry really has to deal with is, like, well, why are we defending this, like, business that's declining in the amount of revenue it brings in and doesn't work, never worked, and people hate it? It's kind of hard to defend. So, yeah.
By the way, Recode, a good example. The Atlantic, a good example. There are good journalistic sites still around doing a good job.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Register is a good example. I think Fortune's a good example.
Gee, thanks.
No, I really do. No, I really do. I read your stuff all the time. And Matthews.
No,
and,
that's great. It just sounded like you're like, wow.
Oh, and by the way, Fortune is not so bad. The internet, it's not that bad, really. Especially if you run an ad blocker. It's great.
Don't say that.
I want to talk about Kara Swisher, who apparently Kara has now decided it's no point in covering Yahoo. Who cares? So now she's turned her baleful glare to Twitter.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And apparently we got a big...
Talk about bayoneting the wounded.
Big day coming tomorrow. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. We had a great week on Twit. Let me show you some of the stuff you missed if you missed shows this week on Twit.
On Twit.
This is the Echo, and I'm going to give you a few tips on new things that she can do. Ask my admirer to say something nice.
I think about you while I'm on the Epiphany toilet.
Should we try that again?
Security Now.
We're still in the early days of Internet of Things, and they're just not secure yet. All of our IoT devices need their own isolated Wi-Fi network.
So you set up the guest Wi-Fi, and you put all the IoT things on that.
Yes.
Know-how.
This is a soft mod called Magic Lantern, and it's a open source way of unlocking all the different features that you should have had available straight from Canon.
Yeah, I would really like to try this on Leo's new camera. He just got this Canon.
Hey!
Tech news today.
We talk a lot about use of VR as a way to increase empathy. Do you think that it does in this case?
Given the fact that I'd only been in these simulations for a few minutes, I was really surprised when I was told that I was going to the slaughterhouse, and I was not only kind of angry but afraid at the same time. I really felt present in that cow body and kind of attached to being a cow.
Twit, it's time to see Leo in the cat suit.
We got a great week ahead. In fact, it's an earnings report week. Let's see what Jason Howell and Megan Maroney will be covering on TNT next.
Hey, thanks so much, Leo. We've got a few things coming up next week on Tech News Today. January 26th has a couple of earnings, Apple and AT&T. It's actually earnings week bonanza this next week. January 27th, Facebook, eBay, Qualcomm, and PayPal. January 28th, and that's Amazon, Microsoft, Electronic Arts, and the Alibaba Group. We're going to check in on some of these, and if they are impactful and impressive, we will let you know all about it next week on the new Tech News Today. We record Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific. So join Megan Maroney and I as we do that. All right, Leo, back to you.
Thank you, Jason Howell. By the way, Mike Elkin will be back tomorrow with me on Triangulation. We're going to interview Bill Fernandez, Apple employee number 4, one of the men behind not only the Apple II, but also the Macintosh. He's the CEO of a new company called Omnibotics, but some Apple memories tomorrow on Triangulation. That should be pretty fun. Always look forward to that. Our show today brought to you by Gazelle, GAZELLE.com. And when new phones come out, when new tablets come out, when new computers come out, it's time to retire the old one. I do hope you don't just throw it in the drawer. That would be such a bad idea. It'd be like taking a $100 bill and just going, hey, you gather dust in there. I won't be using you. Trade in your old device for cash at gazelle.com. And you want to see how much you can get? You can do it right now. You get a quote on your old device. Lots of different kinds of devices. They even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Give you cash.
How much do you think that they would pay for this?
What do you got?
Cracked iPhone. This is a cracked iPhone 5.
Let's find out. Probably not very much. But, hey, it's better than just throwing it in the trash, right? How did you crack it?
I think I just dropped it one too many times. Yeah. It was
How big is it? How much memory? Look, at $75. Wait a minute, broken. Click that again. $20. Hey, that's not bad. You get a sawbuck there. That's not bad. Better than nothing. Anyway, this is a great place to do that. They'll send you a check, a PayPal credit if you're in a hurry, or an Amazon gift card. They'll bump that up by 5%. The point is really not to just take that, but I bet you have a few other gadgets lying around, Aaron. Pile them all in.
Like, I don't know what else to do with this.
Right.
I don't want to throw garbage.
It's recycling it the right way. What they do, they sell it for parts. So it's a really smart idea. And they're going to pay the postage on it, which means you could they'll send you a box. You have 30 days to decide. Go get a quote. Find out. Get all your other stuff in there. They'll buy you. You have a Surface tablet. You got some old, all sorts of stuff. They'll send you a box that you ship it. They send you the cash. It's great. In fact, if it's really broken and you can't, I don't think that's actually broken because it still works, right?
Oh, it works.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's broken. So I think, anyway, they'll adjust it up or down. They're very good about that. They've given me more money several times. And they'll also wipe your data if you can't or forget to do that. Now, It's also a good way to replace that broken iPhone, Aaron, because they sell certified pre-owned devices. They take the best stuff they get. They run it through their 30-point inspection to make sure it's not only fully functional, but there's no major cosmetic issues. And then you can buy it at a significant discount without extending your contract, although they do work, of course, with all the major carriers. They have devices for all of them. iPhone 4S through 6 Plus for iPads, their standard, their Air, their mini models. You can even get Samsung Galaxy phones. So Gazelle, to buy and to sell, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, gazelle.com. One more plug. We've got a Twit newsletter for the first time. We've never done this before. Everybody always said, oh, you don't have a newsletter? Why don't you have? Everybody has a newsletter. People wanted it. We did it. It will just kind of be come out Sundays, and it'll be here's, you know, who are, like Bill Fernandez is going to be on Triangulation, that kind of thing. If you're interested, we promise not to do anything with your email address. We won't send you additional emails. We won't sell it, of course. Twit.tv/newsletter if you want to get the very first edition one. It's going out tonight. Twit.tv/newsletter. And it's double opt-in. Don't worry. Nobody can subscribe. You can't subscribe your enemies to it and all that stuff. We're doing it right. Twit.tv/newsletter. If you didn't see the new screensavers, by the way, we didn't get that into the promo, but that augmented reality sandbox was wild. So cool.
Was this the HoloLens developer kit? So.
Yeah. No. You didn't have to wear anything. It was an actual sandbox with a projector and a Xbox Kinect. And the Kinect would sense your hand and sense the sand. And the idea is you could make terrain. You could have it rain by going like this, and it would rain, and you see water, and it would slosh around. And then you could draw a line in the sand, and the water would flow. You could build up mountains, and it makes a topo map out of it. Got to see this thing. It was so cool. I want to build one because all it takes is a projector and a Kinect.
It's on my downloaded list, so I shall check it out.
And open source software. There it is.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, it's Linux software. It's open source. LakeVIZ.com, LakeViz. It was pretty neat. So Twitter, what's going on? What is going on? Kara Swisher writing in Recode along with Kurt Wagner. He says there's a big executive upheaval coming tomorrow.
The Journal just published a story that says one of the conditions of Jack Dorsey coming back was that the entire board would eventually be replaced.
Yikes. By the way, I don't blame him because on that board was Dick Costolo. He's gone, former CEO.
Yeah.
And Ev Williams, former CEO. You want to get those guys out of there, right? You don't want to be
part of the story with so many startups and Twitter especially is that only the founders, you know, the founders feel such deep, you know, affinity for this thing they started. It's their baby and only they can really save it. But when there's multiple founders, I think it's really hard to give it to one and push the other out. I see that rivalry continuing if Ev Williams eventually gets kicked off the board.
Alex Retter, who is the head of engineering, has left. Kevin Weil, who is the product chief, has left.
Yeah. You see, I'm not entirely sure it's a good idea to bring founders back in. I mean, look what Jerry Yang did to Yahoo. I mean,
it was
not exactly the sharpest tool in the book when it came to taking back the company that he co-founded.
Not saying it has a big success rate. Everyone points to Steve Jobs, but he's the exception. But it is just a really common thing. I mean, it's hard for this happened at Reddit last year too. You know, the founder came back to try to save it after leaving too early. So I just think it's a really strong draw. If a founder leaves the company and they see something going wrong with it, it's really hard for them to not want to step in and fix it. That's what happened with Dorsey, obviously, but Ev Williams is still there too. I just don't see the two of them. I don't see him exiting gracefully.
It does feel like the kind of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. They're just not quite, there's something not quite right going on at Twitter. They just cannot seem to turn what is a globally used platform into something they can make just a teensy bit of money out of to satisfy shareholders.
It doesn't seem like who leaves is as important as who they hire, right? They need somebody. Maybe it's Jack, but they need somebody to figure out what to do, how to save this.
I want to hear what Ohm thinks they should do.
So just to be clear, Jack joined exactly 3.5 months ago. And to think that we will have a miracle turnaround in 3.5 months when they have been dealing with this chaos for a long time is actually kind of ridiculous.
Now, He hasn't done much, though. I mean, he added...
He's done a lot more than what had happened prior to that.
Okay.
What he's trying to do is actually, from what I've heard, is that the company needs to move faster, and there is a certain sense of lethargy in the operation right now, and he needs to overcome that. Like, again, I'm not in the business anymore, so I might not be as up as Aaron and everybody else in the industry is. But that said, I do feel that they need to take a step back in order to make, you know, progress. And I think that's what they're trying to do. This is a company which has too many people. Like, you know, at one point, I saw they had like 3,000 plus people, which is just like, wait, compare that to Facebook, and you start to realize there is a challenge with this company. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes up next. I'll still sit on the sidelines and let Jack make a few moves before I have an opinion.
Paul Kudrowski tweets, being head of product for Twitter is like being a drummer for Spinal Tap. If you saw the movie, you remember that they kept blowing up and disappearing.
Choking on someone else's vomit. Yes.
It's true.
Luckily, Jack is a product guy.
It might
be hard to work for a CEO that really wants to be involved in the product, and then you've got your own ideas, but obviously the CEO/founder is going to trump anything you have.
Yeah.
I mean, every time Twitter tries and changes the mix, you know, there was this rumor a couple of weeks ago they were going to extend the character limits, and people kicked up a storm. Then last year it was injecting ads into your Twitter feed. That kicked up a storm, not doing a strict data feed, but doing like Facebook's organized view of what's going on. Users didn't like that either. I mean, every time they try and change the product, the users kick up a fuss. And it's a question of whether or not they can power through that and push some good changes through, or whether they're just going to say, well, okay, we won't do anything and we'll carry on losing
Moments
money.
Moments a big improvement?
No, Moments is bloody awful.
Does anybody use Moments?
Yeah. No.
So that's, no. I mean, that Jack Dorsey didn't come up with it, but they released it right as soon as the day Jack arrived. Obviously, he said, hey, what do you got? Well, we got this Moments thing. All right, launch it.
Oh, no,
Wasn't that like something, you know, if the Wired article, there was a big Wired article on it.
Yeah, so, we knew it was there.
And that was like Dick Costolo and Kevin Will.
The last act.
Those guys were the architects of that. Right. So, you know, who knows? Again, like, you know, I think there's just too much. People are just like, too much of are in too much of a rush to see the impact. But because this is a company, people use their product every day, so everybody has an opinion about it.
Yes and no, because it doesn't have that many users, to be honest with you.
Really?
It's got a fair few.
300 million is a lot.
300 million, half of whom are bots and spam. So, but let's be generous. We'll say 200 million real users. I think half are not real, but let's say two-thirds. Nothing compared to Facebook, 1.5 billion. It's 200 million is nothing compared to WhatsApp. It's nothing compared to Instagram. I mean, it's just the tech elites are very well aware of, but I wonder if the rest of the world is.
I would say whether it is, you know, you brought up Facebook, there is Instagram. You mean to say there are no spam accounts on those?
No, there are two. But
those are closed silos, so we can't figure out how much of those users are actually nonsense. In case of Twitter, you can, because it's a much more open platform, and you can find out about those things. I actually do believe that at the end of the day, you know, Jack may not have like a year, but he still has another 3 to 4 months to make some moves to see how everything goes. And I think this is part of the change he's trying to bring in. And again, I am not sitting here and saying I have any firsthand knowledge of what he's trying to do. But I do know that, you know, when you have a company of 3,000 plus people, when you have a company which has a very certain way of thinking, you have a lot of legacy thinking, you need to do something radical to get it going again.
Well, right? He's doing that, I think, right?
This whatever. Is... I don't know what he's doing, so I can only comment on what's being published in the media right now. And right. From that standpoint, it seems like he wants to bring in a little bit of his own focused team to make this thing move forward. You know, who knows?
Hopefully nobody from Square. I'm sure that would be a really unusual conflict if he brought somebody over from another company that he's running.
I think part of the reason this comes up is it's so hard for us to think of what would you do to fix it.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, Twitter is very influential within the group of people that use it simply because they got on there first and they tend to be people that the tech industry pays awareness to. But it's such a basic set of functions and they don't seem to be able to change it that much that I do wonder how
They've
long
talked about
because
making
it's...
10,000 character limits.
Well, yeah. I think that speaks to what Om was saying. There's a lot of legacy thinking there. People think that Twitter in its form today is sacred and that they couldn't change it because users would revolt. But that's actually how Facebook got to a billion users, is by creating new, you know, looking at behavior, creating new products that kind of feed into that. And then people freak out. People freaked out when they introduced Newsfeed, which is now basically the core of Facebook.
It is Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, and people boycotted it. There was they were like, you know, pages like, get rid of Newsfeed. We hate this. It's invasive. And now it's obviously the best part, or at least the most familiar part of Facebook. And so I think, like, Ian, you were kind of hinting at this earlier, but like the way for them to succeed now, especially with the founder back in the driver's seat, is to piss off some people, you know, introduce some things that users will initially hate, but eventually adapt to and really love.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think get in there, make some noise and make some changes. I mean, the 140 character limit, I mean, it was a great, cute sort of way of getting things underground, but as soon as you went on Twitter, you saw it wasn't working, because I don't know about you, but when I went on, it was just like, oh, 140 characters, everyone would be composing elegant little haikus of stuff to go out there. Look at this, it's really funny, and then a link. And that's what 90% of tweet posts are.
Yeah.
You know, there's no style, there's no innovation there. So getting rid of that 140 character limit, I say go for it.
You don't think it's just going to become a noisier version of Medium?
Yeah, it could do. I mean, as long as they actually limit it down. I mean, the big advantage I see in Twitter is in that it's a pure data feed. I mean, we're getting to situations now where you can get a tweet. When the Virginia earthquake, I think in 2011, people were getting tweets in New York that an earthquake was occurring, actually before the earthquake hit you, a couple of seconds before, because the data was traveling faster than the shockwave did.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That was cool.
I mean, that's what makes Twitter really special to my mind. Yeah. That kind of pure data flow. And it just 140 characters, it's neither one thing or the other, really.
I feel like there's something radical needs to be done. Bring back developers, open source it. I don't know. There's something radical needs. I know, because you're a publicly held company, unfortunately. This is really the problem that Twitter faces, is they had an IPO, they raised money, and now the expectations are untenable. You can't, I mean, who's calling hardest for Jack to do something quick? Not us, his shareholders.
Yeah. I think you look at, I wrote two blog posts. One, when Twitter went public, I wrote this blog post about to live and die in public. Mm. That's Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it was a little pun intended, in a sense. This is a company which went public. This is a company which lives in public. I don't think any other corporation has the kind of rigorous scrutiny they have at a product level. And so it is very hard to make some changes there. And then another post I wrote recently, which was about some little changes they can make. And the idea I was proposing was, you know, take away the idea that a link should not count to 140 characters. A photo attachment or a dozen photo attachments should not count as attachment to, you know, in a sense, like that should not be towards 140 characters. Make the 140 characters mean a lot more. That is a good starting point. The fact that, you know, we all are talking about radical changes, I think just making small changes is will get this company set on the right path. I think there is, like, people just are looking for a lot of, you know, motion and confusing that for action. And that's not really how you actually try to come back from, you know, this dire situation Twitter is in.
Do you think that they need more users, or that they should just figure out how to make more money on the users that they have?
They need to make the product so much more simpler and attractive so that the new users can come to it and use it and stick to it. People are curious about Twitter. They just don't want to spend time on it because they don't know how to deal with it. And I think they need to figure out how they keep the newcomers on the site and on the service. That is the thing they need to solve. And, you know, I think maybe 10,000 characters solves that problem, right?
Some little thing, a hashtag, an at sign, something.
Mm.
I mean, that's true. The Twitter leverages these minor, tiny changes into something very big.
Yeah, and they have so much data on what people are, you know, reading, tweeting, sharing, whatever, that they can actually be the newspaper of the planet.
They could
without,
be.
Right? And that is a great place for non-power users to start with. Secondly, I think if you really look at this company, you know, it just, the innovation in Twitter comes from its users. Like the Tweetstrom idea didn't come from within Twitter. It came from folks like Mark Andreessen. You know, the idea of, you know, quoting a tweet or doing snapshots of like two or three paragraphs,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's coming from people. Hashtag came from Chris Messina. Like,
that's kind of
like,
what you want, isn't it, with a platform?
Yeah,
you want to make something that's generative that people can use to create.
Yeah.
And then embrace it appropriately.
Yeah, and I think the company's become too big, too bloated, moves much slower than it needs to move much faster. And I don't know what that, you know, what will it take to get to that point, but I think any kind of change, in my opinion, is a good change for this company.
I think the other reason we're fascinated by it, and you point this out in your article, in your column, is that it's a Greek tragedy. That unlike Mark Zuckerberg and Larry and Sergey, who seem like, or Steve Jobs, like, you know, gods on Olympus, Jack and Noah and Ev and Biz are very much mortals with huge failings, as we learn from Nick Bolton's book, Hatching Twitter. And really, it's the amazing drama and craziness around Twitter. It's like a little kind of it's like Charlie Brown's Christmas tree. We just love it, even though it's kind of a little bit of a struggle.
It is one of those tales is both inspirational for Silicon Valley and entrepreneurship, and also kind
and a
of a warning sign as to when to just let it go and when, you know.
Yeah. Twitter can't die, can it?
I think it can be integrated and then fade away. I'm not sure what it's going to
die.
Is it in play? Would be so sad.
Because its stock price is so low, is it in play? Is somebody going to come along and buy it?
Well, the weirdest rumor I heard this week was that Yahoo was going to buy Twitter. And you're
that
like,
would be
it,
sad. That would be
thinking.
Death. That's, you know? That's death right there. That's how you die. It's maybe living the living dead, but it's dead.
Someone just said a geek tragedy. Yes, I can
a
see
geek
that.
Tragedy, it is. So who could buy? I thought Google would be a natural.
They've had their chances before Twitter even went public. They had the chance. Any natural buyer has already had the opportunity.
Yeah.
At this price.
So yeah.
there's only a handful of M&A buyers in Silicon in the tech world these days.
Yeah.
That's the problem with a lot of the overpriced unicorn startups. Also, they only have four or five companies that could actually afford to buy them.
Right. That's why we've kept the value of Twit so low. I never wanted to be a unicorn. I always wanted to be an affordable purchase. we got to find some way for Jack to turn this around. We just need to all pitch in. We could all let's all go over. We'll bring have a potluck. We'll come up with some ideas. We'll just Jack, we're coming. And we'll give you some suggestions. We'll come up, brainstorm something. Folks, our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. We're almost done here. I think we'll wrap it up in just a second. But first, let's tell you that the best way to be a business that mails stuff is to use Stamps.com. It's certainly not to take a walk to the post office, try to park, figure out how to send stuff from the post office. If you're doing that, you need a better way. And Stamps.com is awesome because it starts by buying and printing your own legal U.S. postage from your computer and your printer. No postage meter, no trips to the post office. But it does so much more with their free postage scale, shipping large envelopes or packages. Even easier, you could set it up in minutes. It's so straightforward, and it makes you look so professional. Here's the Stamps.com kit you're going to get. If you go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and use our offer code TWIT. This is a $110 bonus offer. You get the USB scale, which is awesome because you never have to guess what the postage is. That's Carly holding that. She uses, I'm sure, all the time. This is how we do all of our mailings. You also get $55 in free postage. You also get a month trial of Stamps.com. And what's nice is when you print out your Stamps.com label or you print right on the envelope, your logo is there that gets the addressee's information from your website. If you're an Etsy or Amazon or eBay seller, it's so easy. You get discounts you can't get at the post office. Barcoded postage, return and delivery addresses in one step right on the envelope. Don't get that $5 deal. That's ridiculous. See that? Give us a try, get $5 free. No. Click the microphone. You might think, oh, Leo, they're not going to give you $55 in free postage. Click the microphone. Enter the offer code TWIT. Let's just see how much free postage is Stamps.com going to give you. Leo, $55 in free postage, a digital scale, a supplies kit, and yes, a four-week trial of Stamps.com. It really will make your business look more professional and will save you time and it'll save you money. Stamps.com. I wish you to try it. What is YouTube's weird word of football makeup? I keep going to fortune.com/unicorntears or fortune.com/boom and seeing this article. You put this out a couple of days ago.
Yeah, that's the last article I wrote, I guess. YouTube hosted some press event touting whatever Super Bowl ad product they're going to have, and it was pretty... It wasn't that exciting. And that was the best fact that I learned from it was the fact that there are 16 million videos of women showing other women how to put football themed makeup on their faces for the game day. And it just reminded me of how bizarre and full of strange things YouTube is. And so I just did a quick story on it. But a lot of people read it, actually.
You see?
There's a lot of weird stuff on YouTube.
You see? But there's everything's on YouTube. That's why I love YouTube.
Yeah, anything could ever think of in your life that you want to do, there's a how-to on YouTube.
Yeah. Look, here's a panda rolling in snow. Where else would you find that except maybe on your GIF feed on Facebook?
Oh, God, everybody was sending me that thing yesterday. Isn't it cute? Yeah, it was cute the first time.
Yeah.
Because that's shot vertically, it makes me think that it might have been on Snapchat first.
Yeah, I know. It's the amount of damage. Yeah,
that was the sound of minds being blown.
No, it's far too many dank memes on all over social media at the moment.
What kind of memes?
Dank memes.
What's dank?
Oh, just overdone.
Dank memes. I just feel like the animated GIF explosion is just beginning because all the messenger programs now are allowing you to post. I no longer type. In fact, I just got it. Twitter, animated GIFs. It would solve the whole thing because the problem is typing a thought in English. It's so unnuanced, but the GIF can have so much nuance.
Yeah, if you're going to start promoting emojis, then I'm out of here.
No. GIF replaces the emoji. See, it started with emoticons. Semicolon dash right parenthesis.
Okay.
Then the emoji was kind of a flimsy replacement, but it was the same size. Then we had stickers, but they didn't move. Now we have animated GIFs, and they have all the emotional resonance of an emoji, but with the humor and meme creating capability of a sticker. And I mean, that's just awesome.
Could be interesting.
I'm telling you, that's communication.
We're acting like GIFs are this great technological innovation, but they've actually been around since
the oldest thing, since CompuServe.
The man shoveling, the construction guy shoveling, yeah. saying under construction.
Yeah. It's like... yeah. It's invented by CompuServe. So there, and I bet none of you know what CompuServe is.
Oh, yes. I still... I'm just trying to remember my first
75106,3135. Yeah, exactly. You never forget your first number.
Oh, sadly I have, but I guess the years have got away. I wasn't that long on it. But in terms of an email address, it was just like, are you trying to make this difficult to remember and explain to people? Because you're doing a damn good job at it. If so, you know.
7175. But then it was at like at cis.com or something like that. Oh. Netflix whizzes past 75 million subscribers.
Yeah, a lot of those people chilling.
People thought Netflix was over a year ago or 2 years ago when Reed Hastings decided to split the DVD business from the download business. Boy, I knew he was doing the right thing. And, you know, he apologized. Like, we won't do that. And, of course, downloads won. It's over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's a couple of old Blockbuster executives out there who are just like, you know, what could have been? What could have been?
Damn it. Yeah. $1.823 billion in revenue in the fourth quarter, $43 million in profit. The share price up 121% in 2015. And they, of course, expanded in January. They announced the expansion to 130 more countries around the world.
That's such a coup, that little piece right there, because if you look at what's tripped up a lot of the music streaming companies from growing, it's been that they couldn't get the international licenses or that the music industry was really difficult about giving them, you know, access to have fans internationally streaming the content. So the fact that Netflix was able to negotiate that just speaks to how powerful they've become.
And it's the international growth that's important because U.S. growth is slowing.
Yeah.
So international.
But they've done a whole bunch of really interesting stuff with the user traffic in terms of commissioning new stuff for the channel on that. I think Netflix really is a case in point of how you can take something which, A, it was a very disruptive technology, but they haven't just burnt out and smashed everyone else in the business. They've actually developed it and they're now having a really positive effect. And we have a subscription at home. I never thought, you know, the very concept now of going down to a video shop or waiting for something to be on TV is so alien to the new generation coming through that, hey, I think it's a good thing.
We still have a video store in Petaluma. Every time I drive by, it's called Silver Screen Video. I wonder, who the hell's going there?
Actually, I'm heading there later.
Are you
this week.
Going there?
I'm going to go check it out later this week.
What are you getting? DVDs? What are you getting?
I want to see what they got. I want to see what they're doing.
It's a great place to get old VHS tapes because they like you can get 5 movies for $3.
Yeah.
As long
what
as
do
you
play them on?
You don't have a VCR? Come on.
But see, that was the death of Blockbuster because they got rid of the old stuff and all they had was just new release, new release, new release. If you wanted the older things, you had to go to very special places. So.
Yeah,
some of you might note that there was a football game or two on today, and I'm glad that those of you watching live didn't know that, and I'm sorry I told them now. But
great.
Something happened.
Lost everyone.
Something happened during the AFC Championship today. You know, for a long time, the NFL was fighting this uphill battle. All the announcers on the NFL were calling the tablets that they were using iPads, even though they'd made a deal with Microsoft to replace the iPads with Surface tablets.
$450 million deal.
Nice deal.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? The announcers now know that they're Surface tablets because they crashed during the AFC Championship game, and not for the Broncos, just for the Patriots.
Okay. Someone on the Windows team showing their support there for their favorite sporting heroes.
You wouldn't know this because you're a Brit, but it turns out that the Patriots are quite famous for radio and internet issues at their stadium in Foxborough. So I think the Broncos prepared a little welcoming treat at the Denver.
Just to make them feel at home.
Yeah, just to say, hey, you know, those things that you make happen to the other team, guess what? They could happen to you.
I must take objection to the name, though. New England Patriots. Surely that should be New England Rebellious Colonials.
Yes. Thank you. Well, good news. They're not going to the Super Bowl. Oh, no. Actually, my son's going to be devastated. He is a Patriots fan. I grew up in Rhode Island. I'm a Patriots fan. But I want to see the Broncos. I want to see Peyton Manning. Even though some wag on Twitter said, what did he say? Carolina's going to kick your butt. ladies and gentlemen, I think we can wrap this puppy up. Put a bow on it and send everybody home with a smile. and a warm feeling in the pit of their stomach.
Well, we're doing whiskey shots later.
Yes. Aaron, it's so great to have you, and I hope you're not too
Thanks
snowbound.
For having
me. Can you go out the door and shop and stuff? Or?
Yeah, I walked around. Nice. I dropped off my laundry today. There is commerce occurring. Life has moved on.
Did you ride a city bike in the snow?
That would be a bold move. The streets are not okay. Maybe I was overstating how much we've bounced back. The streets are still a disaster.
The only reason I say that, New York Times headline: snow, ice, and wind, no issue for city bikes diehards. There are still plenty of people in New York City. Here's just riding around on their rental bikes.
I'm not a diehard.
Yeah, but there
not
are plenty of people in New York City who've embraced public urination as a lifestyle choice. I mean, it's not really something that you can...
New York is a great city.
Oh, it is. It is. Absolutely. I was there for the last blizzard, in fact, and people were panic buying, it seemed, whiskey, batteries, and soy milk for some strange reason.
Perfect. I'd add toilet paper to that and you're set. Have you used the Link NYC Wi-Fi yet, Aaron?
No.
That's that really fast Wi-Fi it's in the old phone booths in Manhattan.
Oh, you know.
You don't even know about it. This is typical. You know, there's this thing in the middle of the bay there that's called the Statue of Liberty. You should go visit it. I hear a wonderful sight.
You know,
New Yorkers don't appreciate it.
To me, when I was working remotely and I was in and out of coffee shops and parks and trying to find walking around with my laptop trying to find Wi-Fi wherever. But now I'm in a big office complex the train pretty much drops me off right there. So
it's pretty cool.
And in the wintertime, we don't wander too far from where we need to be.
There's Times Square.
Oh, it's not looking too grisly there. There are at least people walking.
Is this live, Jason?
Yeah, it's live. Earthcam.
It's melted. The snow's all melted.
No, that's a real city.
It's just nasty slush now.
Yeah, just dirty, dirty, ugly slush with some yellow.
I think this is what a real city looks like.
Isn't that beautiful?
No, they have a blizzard and they clean it up and they can get on with it.
Move on with your life.
It's not like San Francisco. We have rain and there is just like pileups.
Yep. Oh,
yeah, with you on that. I mean, San Francisco drivers aren't the best of aren't particularly good at the best of times. Throw some rain in there and it's kamikaze death race 2000 on the highway.
Imagine if it snowed in San Francisco.
Oh, for goodness sake. It would be the apocalypse. Insane. They'd have to call the National Guard out.
Yeah. Aaron Griffith, go to fortune.com/your choice, boom or unicorn tears. Either one works.
Thanks.
Nice to see you. Thank you for joining us today. It's great to have you. Also, you too, Om Malik, om.co, the shortest URL on the internet, omco, om.co. I love it. At Om on the Twitter.
I think o.co is the shortest.
Does somebody have that?
Yeah, isn't that some company, Overstock?
That's right. Overstock has it. Nobody uses it. They think this can't possibly work.
It obviously does. It's...
I am jealous that you have at home. I read that article. I thought it was very interesting. Your first tweet, which was in 2006 when Twitter was just launching, it still had no vowels, was on a Nokia E71 phone.
Hey,
wow.
You know, I'm sure there's a shortage of vowels in my life. So.
No vowels. Great to have you home. Thanks for being here. We really appreciate it. And you too, Mr. Ian Thompson of the register.co.uk.
Well, great fun as always.
Keep up the good snarking under the red banner. I did not know that.
Yeah, the red tops. It's just a term.
Now you know it's a tabloid.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Want to thank everybody who joins us each and every week. We do the show live, and I know a lot of people, thousands of people, like to watch live, be in the chat room, and I appreciate that. It's a 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC on Sunday afternoons, Sunday evening, Sunday night, depending on where you are. Could be Sunday morning, depending on where you are. Monday morning. I don't think it could be Sunday morning.
No, Monday morning. Down in Australia at this point. Yeah.
Good morning, mate.
Although I think it's National Holiday in Australia today.
National what?
I think it's National Holiday in Australia today.
Is it really?
I think our Australian office, at least they've told us it's a national holiday. I'm going to have to check that now.
Somehow it sounds like a line. Oh, no, we're not coming in.
No, it's
an holiday.
It's Aussie Wacker Day. Yeah.
Aussie Wacker Day. Oi. If you would like to get the download, you can do that too. Twit.tv, youtube.com/thisweekintech. Of course, every podcast client, you can always get it. Subscribe. That way you get it each and every week. And don't forget, the speaking of subscriptions, twit.tv/newsletter if you'd like to get our newsletter. If you'd like to be in the studio, we have five people bored to death right now. And no, they're having a great time. And you too can do that. When will this be over? Email tickets at twit.tv and we will put a seat out for you. Is there, Jason, is there, have I left anything out, Jason Calacanis? Jason Calacanis. No. Jason Kleanthis. I know Jason Calacanis will be here next week, yep, along with Alex Wilhelm. Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
And Roberto Baldwin from Engadget. He's new. So
now you've got the riot police alerted for that.
Yeah,
right?
that's gonna be a treat and a half.
And tomorrow's strangulation.
Yeah, we're gonna have fun with Bill Fernandez and Mike Elgin's gonna stop by for that. So that's gonna be a lot of fun. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.
He's in the can. Bravo, bravo. Doing the twit.